Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, it's all the president's henchmen. Turns out Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on that Ukraine call. William Barr went globetrotting at the president's bidding to discredit our own intelligence agencies. Mike Pence is vaporized. And Rudy, well, he's off the hook because we all know he's the hero, right? We'll open the lines and ask you, is there one scintilla of integrity in Trump's White House? Then California Governor Gavin Newsom says colleges reap billions of dollars from student-athletes who never see a cent. He just put an end to that by signing the Fair Pay to Play Act into law. We'll talk to Trini Kuznarek about that and more.
Are we having a beef with meat for no reason? Good news for anyone who ordered the gym sandwich today at the Newsfeed Cafe. New guidelines say red and processed meats are A-OK. Food writer Corby Kammer joins us for that and more on Boston Public Radio. 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
You almost didn't mention I was here. Did you notice that little slip?
Well, I was thinking of Ted Koppel, you know, X number of days of America being held hostage.
I remember very well the Iranian hostages.
We have to think about that, America being held hostage.
This is day eight, isn't it?
Inquiry.
I think it is. In any case, President Trump ran on draining the swamp, but instead it's like he filled the place with mud, sand, and Miracle-Gro to create swamp creatures in his own image. Today we learned Mike Pompeo was on that Ukraine call, even though he said he knew nothing about it just days ago. Today we also learned William Barr, he's the Attorney General, traveled the world to do Trump's bidding, meeting with foreign officials in an effort to discredit our own intelligence agencies and their investigation into the Trump 2016 campaign's interactions with Russia. And in the foreground, we've got the president ramping up his attacks on the whistleblower. From the culture of lies to the botched cover-ups, we're opening the lines asking you, Trump supporter or not, is this level of corruption, buffoonery, and thuggery not a concern for you? 877-301-8970. By the way, just so you don't think we're engaging in hyperbole, when I mentioned Mike Pompeo was on the call after having said he wasn't. Well, Martha Raddatz, a local woman who's made good, I should say, the least.
She's on Channel 5.
She's hosting this week on ABC News, and she's got Secretary of State Pompeo on. Listen to her question and listen to what Pompeo says. Again, this is Sunday, in advance of us knowing that he was on the actual call with the president of Ukraine. Here it is.
I want to turn to this whistleblower complaint, Mr. Secretary. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that President Trump pressed the president of Ukraine 8 times to work with Rudy Giuliani to investigate Joe Biden's son. What do you know about those conversations?
So you just gave me a report about a IEC whistleblower complaint, none of which I've seen. We'll see President Zelensky this week. We want a good relationship with the Ukrainian people.
So wait a second. He was, according to news reports, he was on the call.
Right.
But when she says, what do you know about those conversations? Pompeo says, I haven't seen the whistleblower complaint yet. So what? You were on the call. What is he going to say today when someone yells a question out to him and says, Mr. Secretary, you were on the call and you said you hadn't read the whistleblower report. What does that have to do with it?
I don't know. We'll have to see what people like Lindsey Graham say and Jim Jordan say, the congressman today, who've been talking about the whistleblower couldn't be believed because it was all hearsay.
Second hand, third hand, right?
And then the intelligence IG refutes that it was and says that at least in several cases the whistleblower did have first-hand knowledge. Not that hearsay when it's from a bunch of people would disqualify the whistleblower, but that major talking point, this is all hearsay, 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 has just been blown up. So we'll see what Lindsey Graham says now, and Jim Jordan, who of course was on with Jake Tapper, talking like 90 miles a minute. It was incredible how fast he was talking.
And Tapper fact-checking him as they're going along, and I think, to say the least, exposing him for being a total fraud.
Yeah,
but you know,
and,
on a serious, by the way, can
they're trying to mix up. They're trying to mix up prosecutors. The Republicans are trying to mix up the prosecutors. The one Biden the senior was trying to get rid of was the guy that wasn't doing anything, any investigations, including investigating
his
own son.
He wanted someone to actually investigate corruption.
So you could say that what Biden senior was doing was going to hurt his son because he wanted to get a more aggressive prosecutor who would have looked into a bunch of things, including this oligarch and this oil company.
Well, can I tell you, his son should still not have been making $50,000 a month when he's overseeing Ukraine.
He should not.
Can I tell you,
and neither should Ivanka Trump.
This is not about Jim Jordan today and Ivanka Trump, Marjorie. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The men closest to the president of the United
States. Haldeman and Ehrlichman?
It is. It essentially is. William Barr is traveling the world, the United States Attorney General, soliciting help from other governments to undermine the conclusions of our own intelligence agencies.
Services.
That's one.
Yeah.
We have the Secretary of State.
Let's think about that for a second. He wants these other countries, Australia, Italy, Greece, as far as we know, who knows how far it could, to undermine the United States of America's intelligence.
And why? Why is that a goal?
Because like Bossert said, the former Homeland Security guy to Trump, he was a Trump appointee, or Trump hire, whatever you want to call it, that the president apparently has turned into Captain Ahab in the Moby Dick book, and all he is obsessed...
And 2016 is the whale.
He is obsessed with writing what he sees as a... He buys into conspiracy theories, and so we learn, kind of frighteningly, does the attorney general, buys into these conspiracy theories, and he wants to prove that Russia had nothing to do with the 2016 election, even though we had some of the brightest minds in the United States for 2 years investigating the Russia connection. And when you read the Mueller report, you see that the tentacles of the Russian government were everywhere.
Okay, so we have Barr doing this, trying to undermine our own country's intelligence agencies, which were unanimous in their conclusion on Russian interference. We have Pompeo essentially lying on television about and not disclosing that he was actually on the call when he's asked about the conversation. And then we have a guy who has totally lost his marbles, who is, you know, I was going to laugh too, but it's not so funny. If you haven't heard this, this is Rudy Giuliani, the president, as we call him, this TV lawyer. And he's in an interview the other day with Chris Cuomo on CNN. And listen, forget fact-checking. He fact-checked himself. Listen carefully to the Cuomo conversation with Giuliani originally saying what he hadn't done and then acknowledging that he had. Here it is.
You never asked anything about Hunter Biden. You never asked anything about Joe Biden.
The only thing I asked about Joe Biden is to get to the bottom of how it was that Lutsenko, who was appointed, dismissed the case against Antac.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
No, I didn't ask him to look into Joe Biden. I asked him to look into the allegations that related to my client, which tangentially involved Joe Biden in a massive bribery scheme.
Rudy, I have no problem with you launching allegations, but just be careful about what you say. I asked you, did you ask Ukraine to look at Joe Biden? You said no. Then you went on to say that you did.
And by the way, the no that Cuomo was referring to was about 10 seconds before that soundbite started. So we have Rudy Giuliani, his chief lawyer. We have the Attorney General of the United States traveling the globe trying to undermine our own intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. And we have the Secretary of State not disclosing that he was on the phone call suggesting, I can't answer your question about the conversation because I haven't read the whistleblower report, which, by the way, strains credibility to begin with, that he hadn't read the whistleblower report.
No, he was trying to finesse it. He was trying to dance around it. He's a smart guy, wanted to make it seem like it was about the whistleblower transcript instead of about the phone call.
So what do the Democrats do about this? While they're deciding how to handle the arguable impeachable offense committed by the President of the United States when he solicited dirt on a potential political opponent from a foreign government. What do they do about all this? What do they do about the fact that Pompeo is now suggesting that his people in the State Department may not comply with congressional subpoenas because it's, quote, bullying, or we call it oversight. He calls it bullying. What do they do about that? What do they do about the President of the United States saying we're trying to find out who the whistleblower is in clear contravention of the whistleblower law that was created intentionally to provide anonymity and protection to a whistleblower?
I am not a lawyer, Jim, but I would say we are seeing obstruction of justice right in front of our eyes over and over again.
Can the Democrats handle it?
I don't know. I really don't know. But before we get to the phone calls, I just have to play this bit of sound because this is the president himself admitting the crime. This was on September 22nd when he was talking to reporters about his conversation with the Ukrainian president.
The conversation I had was largely congratulatory, was largely corruption, all of the corruption taking place, was largely the fact that we don't want our people, like Vice President Biden and his son, creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine. And Ukraine's got a lot of problems.
That was before the summary of the call was released, correct?
That is the President of the United States, before the summary of the call was released, admitting that he was on the phone with the President of Ukraine, asking him to investigate Joe Biden, his chief opponent in the 2020 election, for corruption.
Okay, so you're, before we get the calls, you're a smart Republican senator, and you're having lunch, or you're at the gym this morning with another smart Republican senator. What kind of conversation are you having about all this is going on? We just have to keep stonewalling it. The president did nothing. By the way, none of them are well, obviously they can't deny that Trump made this solicitation, because Trump himself admits it in the transcript or the summary set. What are these people saying to each other?
Well,
what are they?
I would hope, and this is probably a ridiculous hope, but I would hope that they might listen to what the former senator, Jeff Flake of Arizona, said yesterday.
Senator.
Yes, that's right. He quit because he was opposing Trump in many areas, and he knew he was going to lose, so he quit before he was voted out. But in a piece in the Washington Post, he describes removing Trump from office through impeachment as a tough call, but argues that the Republicans must oppose his reelection. Quote, trust me when I say, this is Flake talking to his fellow Republicans, trust me when I say you can go elsewhere for a job, but you cannot go elsewhere for soul.
877-301-8970. So that's the best update we can possibly give you about where we are. If you want to give us your two cents on where you are on this, I think it's day eight of this impeachment inquiry, we'd love you to do that. Nick in Brighton, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you so much for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I just preface this by saying I wouldn't classify myself as a Republican, so I can't really weigh in on that bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure how Republican members of my family can still support this, even, you know, this impeachment inquiry aside. I don't know where the shame comes in, just watching a president kind of take this, like, anger at the previous administration and totally let it affect his national or international policy by supporting North Korea and blowing up the Iran nuclear deal. Meanwhile, he just surrounds himself with yes men. But I honestly don't know how these people were ever qualified for this position, even from a Republican standpoint. It's not just a difference in policy, but they don't seem to know how to even go about doing anything efficiently or without breaking the law in some fashion.
Nick, can we go back to your family for a second? I would say the vast majority of people who mention their family say that somewhere in there, they're Trump supporters, they were Clinton supporters, there's a diversity of worldview. Have you had that conversation with Trump family, with family members who are Trump supporters?
Yeah.
About whether, and what do they say now?
Now, I think they're a little ashamed of themselves. My mother, for example, voted for him, and she won't.
She won't what? We lost you.
At least saying, like, maybe this is a mistake.
Well, does your mother think there should be an impeachment inquiry, or she thinks no problem, move on?
Oh, we haven't even gotten to that.
One step. Hey, Nick, we would love for you to stay in touch with us and let us know how it goes with the fam there. Stay in touch,
but
and
I
thanks
think,
for the call.
But
we
I
appreciate
think
it.
In defense of Nick's family and lots of other families, they're like addicted to Fox News, where the obfuscation and the lies are coming fast and furious every single night.
Okay, can I quote one of your favorite political thinkers? That'd be you.
Yeah.
Yesterday, saying people don't have 15 minutes to read the damn newspaper. This is, you know, as I've said a million times.
Well, they should read the newspaper.
The beauty of this versus Mueller.
Let them read a conservative newspaper, the Wall Street Journal.
The beauty of this as compared to the Mueller thing, where I would argue, I'm with you, that the 10 obstruction items listed are pretty clear on their face if you bother to read the damn thing. The whole package is a little more confusing. This is as simple as the nose on your face. And it is really, really hard.
This is much worse, because in the Mueller report, you at least had the Russians coming to us before the Trump campaign went to him. In this case, you have the President of the United States. I mean, there's been many stories about what Alexander Hamilton thought about this, what Thomas Jefferson thought about this, what George Washington thought about this.
That's what they're worried about.
This is a big deal in the Federalist Papers and the Constitution, the fear of other countries interfering with the operations of the United States of America. So here you have, and Republicans are always big on the Constitution up until Trump came along, that he solicited from a president of another country, which is fighting off his friend, Vladimir Putin, help to undermine our election.
You know,
it's as clear as day.
One last thing before we get back to the calls here is, you know, I have talked a lot on the show, and I've interviewed some of the psychiatrists who are part of that book talking about Donald Trump's mental state. What does it say to you about a person who's elected to the most powerful position in the world and 3 years later sends his attorney general out to try to work to undermine his own intelligence agencies for fear that the election that is over and that he won will be undermined in the minds of some unless the Russian interference is disproven? I mean, what does that say about the state of mind of the man who is directing this effort?
I think many people have concluded this for whatever reason. I don't know if it was his father or his mother or what happened, but he's an incredibly insecure person. Obviously.
Think so?
Yeah, and it's ironic because he's the most powerful man on earth, but he is incredibly insecure, and the idea that he didn't win 2016 fair and square drives him bananas.
Let's go to Brendan in Boston. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling, Brendan. Hi.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. You know, to me, this is a really big indicator of what happens in a country when the closest thing to civic education we have is Game of Thrones and not in the classroom. You know, I really worry that this is just a much different ballgame than the late 90s and the early 70s with those impeachments. I just think it's much more zero-sum game. And frankly, the Republicans have been corrupt and, you know, scandalous for decades now. They've taken the gloves off a long time ago. It's far past time for Democrats to do the same. However, you know, I don't know if Trump's supporters are going to abandon him. My brother, God bless him, is the guy he could have shot on Fifth Avenue and not lost his vote. And he hasn't moved an inch. He thinks Joe Biden's going to go to jail anytime now, and Hillary with him. So, I think Democrats need to get real tough. That's the only way we
can. What does that mean? Brendan, explain what real tough means. What should they do that they're not doing?
Well, I mean, they should have thrown the book at these guys a long time ago. I mean, Pelosi waited way too long for impeachment. You know, I agree with a caller you had a few days ago who said that maybe if impeachment proceedings were already happening when this Ukraine story broke, it would have been the straw to break the camel's back in some ways. Maybe that's optimistic, but I think they need to throw everything that they have at them. And don't worry about the political ramifications of it. This is about the survival of the country.
I agree with that. But the one place, and by the way, I have been critical of Nancy Pelosi for waiting so long. However, and I don't think she did make the decision to proceed. Her members made the decision to proceed, and she had no choice. But putting that aside, the beauty of waiting for this moment, Brendan, is, as we've said repeatedly the last few days, of all the, I would argue, charges against the President of the United States, this to me is the easiest to comprehend. Not to mention the fact, as Marjorie says every single day, it's not an allegation. The President, out of his own lips, has acknowledged that he did what he's accused of doing. So while waiting may have been a poor choice for other reasons, this may be the easiest one, the simplest one to convey to the American people. Brendan, thanks. Keep us surprised about your brother, too. We'd like to know what's going on with him. 877-301-8970.
We're talking about the impeachment of the President of the United States. All the President's men seem to be gathered around him and implicated in this entire mess. We're going to keep talking about it on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we're going over the latest news coming off the impeachment inquiry. And it's not looking, I would argue, particularly good for some of the people in Trump's cabinet, to Mike Pompeo, who actually, it turns out, was, according to reports, was on the phone call with the president of Ukraine, even though he suggests he doesn't know anything about it because he hadn't read the whistleblower's report, to William Barr, who is traveling all around the world at the president's request to attempt to undermine our intelligence agencies and demonstrate that the Russians had nothing to do with the election. on, and then there's Rudy Giuliani. Make what you will of him. We're taking your calls at 877-301-8970. Where do you want to go, Marjorie?
I have an email from Pam who says, you know, if this Trump presidency were a novel, it would be universally panned by critics as being too far-fetched.
Well, do you remember what Chuck Todd said to us a week or so? Was it Chuck Todd, I think, who said to us, can you imagine any – if Donald Trump was the head of any company, any nonprofit, any anything – can you imagine him keeping his job under these circumstances?
Well, I tell you, we're just looking at Debbie Dingell, who's from Michigan, talking on CNN, and she's talking about this massive online campaign that the president and his supporters will launch and millions of dollars to try to confuse people. And we get confused emails every day from people who, I mean, you heard Rudy Giuliani accusing Joe Biden of bribery. There was no bribery. It's just a lie. It's just a lie. I mean, I think we should stop. You got to be very tough, and reporters have to be very tough when these guys get on television and they start spouting these lies.
They have been.
Well, they, you know,
Mike Wallace, you've talked about. Chris Wallace was spectacular.
Jake Tapper was spectacular.
Stephen Miller, Jake Tapper was great with Jim Jordan.
But I think it's important to say they're lies. Not there's no evidence of that, but that's a lie, Mr. Speaker. That's a lie, Mr. Secretary, because that's what they're doing.
Did you see on 60 Minutes? I didn't watch 60 Minutes till last night. Did you see when Kevin McCarthy? No, when Kevin McCarthy is there?
Yes.
He didn't even know what was said by the President of the United States. He's correcting the interviewer, and the interviewer says, I'm actually reading from the President's own transcript or summary of his conversation.
Yeah. Well, I've tended to doubt them when they say they haven't read it. They just want to admit they've read it.
Well, I think you look like a fool. Kirk on the road, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in. Hi.
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 I'm on 93. I'm on 93, headed to Boston now. So
good.
I just wanted to make my statement about the fact that with the culture of lies in the White House since day one with Trump, because obviously he's incapable of telling the truth, the people that he has put in their positions are all operating on that same playbook, but they are not like him because he's not accountable to anybody, but they are. Mm-hmm. And I think they're going to go down for it. I think the like I said, culture of corruption. If it weren't so horrible, it would be amusing to watch.
Well, you know, when you say they're going to go down, Kirk, I hope that if they have done what we think they have done, they do. But all I can think back to was the House Judiciary Committee hearing about a week or so ago with Corey Lewandowski, which was their first test. And as disgraceful as Lewandowski's performance was, I would argue it was matched by the rank ineptitude of the Democrats on the committee. So while it may be clear to you and it may be clear to us, they haven't demonstrated to me yet that they have the ability to pull this thing together. But, you know, essentially the administration seems to be presenting it on a silver platter. Thanks for your call. Drive safely.
You know what is encouraging, though, for people who are not fans of the president, that polls are finding this kind of dramatic switch.
Yeah, it's amazing.
In people's opinions. Apparently there's a new poll out that shows that there's been a rise in impeachment support, even among Republicans and among younger Republicans particularly. But Quinnipiac had a poll. There was another poll by, I think, CBS.
CNN has one. John King will take us about it.
Yeah, so that's pretty dramatic, the turnarounds.
It's only a week also, by the way.
Yeah. So, anyway, let's go to Jim in the car. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Hi. You guys are looking for 2 cents. Here's the first one. Don't forget that in the transcript of the phone call that was given to us by White House staffers from the Situation Room.
Yeah, we should call it a memo because it's not a transcript. You're right, Jim. It's a memo of notes taken.
But go ahead.
And obviously, as they're editing that to get it into the final format, someone or maybe several may have deleted things that were incredibly embarrassing, but that's neither here nor there. The second point is the president basically says one time, I want you to look into Joe Biden. And yet every time I read the reviews in the Globe or in the New York Times, I see the reporters saying over and over and over, he repeated his requests that Joe Biden be looked at. And that's not accurate, according to the memo. So we got to play this straight. You can't embellish things and have things blown out of proportion, because that gives Jim's good friend Joe Malone more ammunition to come back and say everything's fake news. We got to play it straight.
Well, by the way,
the whistleblower said it was multiple times.
Exactly.
Yeah, the whistleblower
so I would suggest,
said it.
Yeah, I don't think they're blowing up anything. Read the whistleblower letter letter complaint from cover to cover, and he talks about multiple times. By the way, Joe Malone, that the Jim is referring to, former treasurer of Massachusetts, former Republican, now an independent, who is a big Donald Trump supporter. Jim, I'm where Marjorie is. I don't think there's been any embellishment at all of what has gone on. It's just gotten worse and worse every day. So we take your cautionary note to heart, but I don't think you're right in this particular instance. Jim, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970.
Jeff from Plymouth. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi, guys. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a daily listener.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks.
I'd like to make two points. The first point is it really depresses me that after the ICE raids, after separating children from their families and, you know, probably resulting in emotional and developmental delays for these children, after the Yemen drone strike that killed dozens of civilians, this is the thing that makes Pelosi kind of wake up and say, oh, yeah, we got to start this seriously, guys. So, you know, as someone who just is not particularly surprised that this is what was going on, it disappoints me that it's taken the Democrats so long to do this.
Well, by the way, I'm glad you said Democrats at the end, because as I said a few minutes ago to another caller, Jeff, I don't think Pelosi made the decision to proceed here.
Right.
I think her members made the decision for her. They were more respectful of her position until, I guess, 8 or 9 days ago, whatever it was. And then ultimately, there were so many of them. I think she had no choice but to go along. And, you know, one of the big controversies, I'm sure you know this, Jeff, is there are a lot of Democrats who want to expand the impeachment inquiry into a whole host of issues, including the ones that you've mentioned about the cages for the kids, the family separation, the 10 obstruction items in the Mueller memo. But at least so far, Mueller and her caucus has said, stay the course, keep it narrow, keep it on Ukraine. And that's going to be a big debate within the Democratic Party.
What's your second point, Jeff?
My second point is just that I think Democrats do need to be careful of giving too much credit to the intelligence agencies, only because the left in this country has a rich tradition of being very critical of the FBI and the CIA. You know, the FBI with COINTELPRO investigating black activists and so on, the CIA overthrowing democratically elected governments in South America. I mean, I think we have to be careful about being too celebratory about how great the FBI and the CIA are. I think, you know, obviously it's very troubling what Trump is doing with trying to undermine what the CIA and FBI said about Russian interference. But I do think we need to still maintain a critical distance as leftists
about
our own intelligence agency.
But, you know, I think in the case, if you're talking about the Mueller report, most of the obstruction of justice, the president did right in front of us. I mean, he fired Jim Comey. We learned from the Mueller report that he tried to get McGahn, his counsel, to lie about it. But I think, to me, it's a case-by-case basis, Jeff. I mean, obviously, in Boston, here we all know the FBI disgraced itself in the Whitey Bulger situation, where they had, you know, a whistleblower that, a FBI agent that was in cahoots, and perhaps many other FBI people that were in cahoots with Whitey Bulger, and because of that, murders went on for years. It didn't have to. But I think this Mueller himself has proven to be sort of a straight arrow. He is an unimpressive witness, but a straight arrow. And the report itself is pretty well documented. And the obstruction of justice, you know, as I said, the president didn't play in sight, a lot of it.
By the way, Jeff, thank you for your thoughts. Can I get back to what Jim said a minute ago about the embellishment thing?
Yeah.
And you and I both said read the whistleblower's complaint. I just was, while you were talking to Jeff, is that who it was? I was skimming quickly the summary of the phone call. I got up to 6 number, just quick. And I assume if I had more time, I would have gotten 8. It's not just an answer to Jim, him mentioning investigate Biden. He keeps repeating after he says Giuliani and Barr, it would be great if you work with him. He mentions Giuliani repeatedly. So with all due respect, Jim, I think you're nitpicking, to say the least. He introduces the Biden topic by saying, please work with my lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. And he mentions Giuliani repeatedly and the contact they should have. In the summary of the call.
But I think that Jim's important point took away was that we should not assume that these memos based on this call are necessarily complete or necessarily accurate, because they were given to report reporters by the White House, and the only reason, obviously, we even got to see them, or the whistleblower's complaint, because the Department of Justice was going to deep six that, William Barr was going to deep six that, is because of the impeachment inquiry.
Well, there's also a press. I thought you were going to say Barr cooked the Mueller report, so there's no reason. And by the way, let me just clarify one thing here. The White House is saying, in answer to the point about the summary of the call, that the ellipses that are in there do not refer, this is what they say, I'm not vouching for it, do not speak to items that were removed for national security reasons, only if things are in square brackets they did. Again, I have no idea if it's
true.
That
might be true.
We
don't know.
When you're reading it, that's what their contention is.
Okay, we are moving on to talk about some sports with Trenny Kuznarek, the latest headlines at the intersection of sports and society. Trenny Kuznarek, a reporter and anchor for NBC Sports Boston, is next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of sports and society is Trenny Kuznarek. Trenny's a reporter and anchor for NBC Sports Boston. Hello, Trenny Kuznarek.
Hello, Jim.
We need a mic. Say it again.
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Trenny. Nice to talk to you.
So, I hope my team's not silenced like that tonight against the Nationals. Do you like I did that?
Oh, very
Oh, that's
nice.
Right. You're a Brewer kind of gal.
Kind of. They're like my end-all be-all.
Is that the Brewer thing on your
it's
sweatshirt?
Yeah, old school M&B.
Oh.
I thought you of all people would notice.
I did not know that.
Because of my Philly thing, you mean?
Well, because you're a sports fan.
I am a hometown kind of guy. It's true.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I'm not as much of a big football fan
Here we
anymore,
go.
Particularly
go ahead.
Football, because I just saw this helmet-to-helmet hit. Which game was that you showed me, Jim?
I showed you the one with the guy who was suspended for the whole season. What's his name?
Vontaze Burfict.
For the Oakland Raiders? That
yes.
Against the Indianapolis Colts.
Correct.
Yeah, it was absolutely sickening to watch it. I mean, the guy went aimed helmet-to-helmet. But you point out in your notes for us today that there were four notable helmet-to-helmet hits in NFL games this weekend.
Yeah,
there
were two in the Packers-Eagles game within really minutes of each other. There was a helmet-to-helmet hit on a punt return that was not flagged or called for anything, and the player was not carted off the field. There was a second one to running back Jamal Williams, who I believe actually was going up for a pass. He crumbled to the ground, had to be taken off on a stretcher and taken to a hospital. There was one Jonathan Jones in the Sunday game against Josh Allen, the Bills quarterback. Jonathan Jones, a cornerback for the Patriots. And then Vontaze Burfict on Jack Doyle in the Indianapolis game. Now, I will say this. If you watch the one that happened between Jonathan Jones and Josh Allen, that is probably one of the least egregious of it. If you actually watch the video, Jonathan Jones does what you're supposed to do. He turns his body sideways. He does not lean with his head. It just happened to be, I think, that the way that Josh Allen scrambled out of the pocket and he started to fall, I think it was just timing, speed, everything. Your helmet hits, you crumple to the ground, you go into concussion protocol. The one on Jamal Williams, even that one, it didn't look to me like the defender whose name is escaping me right now. I think it was Derek Brooks, maybe. He felt terrible afterwards. Like, you could see there was no intent to hurt him. Vontaze Burfict is an entirely different story. Vontaze Burfict and what he did to Doyle is uncalled for. This is not the first time that he's done it. He has been suspended before for unnecessary roughness on the field, thus leading to an entire season and postseason suspension. So Burfict will not be able to play in the NFL again until next year. And I'm hopeful that maybe teams look at him and say, no, we are not going to sign you because you have now intentionally tried, your game is to intentionally try to hurt someone, and we know too much, and we're not going to let you back in the league, and we're not going to sign you.
Can we talk about this guy for a minute? Because, again, it's hard when you don't have the videos here. My understanding of the rules and the pros, and I could be wrong, is if you go down, you have the ball on offense, you go down, and you're not touched by anybody on the team, and this guy was on the ground on his knee, that all the opposition has to do is touch you. Is that not true? And
yes.
You're down. And if they don't touch you, you can get up again,
yes.
And you can keep running.
Yes.
So this guy is not, you know, unlike the quarterback the other day for the Bills.
Josh Allen.
That whole back and forth thing, and I agree with your analysis. Here's a player for the, Doyle is his name, for the Indianapolis
yep.
Colts, who is on the ground. All this perfect has to do when he
it's
runs up
him.
To him is tap him with his finger on his
or,
head.
Or yeah, shove him over.
Or whatever,
whatever
it is. But
you know.
As long as he touches him, he is down. And the guy is on his knee, and he charges at him helmet first. And I don't think I've used this expression in years. Good for the NFL. Good for the NFL
yeah, it
for,
was very
for giving
hopeful
this guy the biggest penalty they could.
But you know what I wanted to ask you? Is it credible that the tight end, the Indianapolis Colts tight end that was hit like this, this Jack Doyle we're talking about, he said he didn't see the actual film, but he said he didn't feel anything from it. He said he joked that he had to come at him a little harder. He didn't feel bad. Is that credible?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, these guys, you know, what is feel bad, right? You know, when your body goes through what it goes through every single Sunday. I mean, I don't know. I've only had one concussion in my entire life. I know that it affected me greatly. I had vomiting and headaches and was, you know, sick for a couple days.
Can I ask?
Yeah, I was. No, you can ask. I was like 15 or 16 years old. I weighed like 92 pounds, you know, this teeny little thing. And I was on a trampoline, and I was being sent up. I was on a trampoline with a bunch of other guys my age, and they were like, whoa, look at how high we can send little Trenny up in the air. And I think I went to, like, bounce on my butt and pop back up on my feet. And when I bounced, I hit backwards, and I smashed my head on the back of the trampoline. And I remember saying at the time, and there was a nurse there, and she sort of diminished, I'll never forget it, she really diminished my symptoms. I think she thought I was being overly dramatic because I wanted, like, attention from the boys. But I went to Six Flags the next day and was on a roller coaster and immediately got dizzy. And my dad had to drive to the Six Flags to come get me because I almost passed out. I was throwing up. I had all these concussive symptoms, and I don't think we really did much for it, but I wasn't involved in any sort of sports at the time that would have aggravated it, so I just rested and you know, got better.
Do you know that's one of the first things they tell you when you get
What's
a concussion
that?
Now, don't go on any roller coasters.
Oh yeah, I went on, I did, I went on like, I went on, I was like, oh, I'm fine, this nurse said I'm fine,
well,
this person's mom, you know, looking back now and with maturity and hindsight, it was clear that she felt I was being overly dramatic, and I was just, again, just trying to be like this flirtatious 16-year-old with these cute boys, right? But that wasn't it at all. I was legitimately sick.
And really, it was only 10 or 15 years ago that we even began taking these cases seriously, because
right.
that was when they began to have the tests.
Wait,
in the
high
school.
It was fewer years ago when the highlight stuff on all the sports casts,
oh, yeah,
where
have,
the helmet
like,
to helmet hits and how exciting it was.
Like it would be like a, like it would be a high, you're right, it would be like, there was like a saying for it. I forget what it was on ESPN, but you know, they would be like, boom, yeah. What I mean, I used to cheer when guys got hit like that. I used to exclaim, hit them harder. Yeah, what a, you know, knock them to the ground. Now, I mean, I'm not joking. I was listening to the Packers, the part of the Packers game where Jamal Williams got the helmet to helmet hit, and then he was lying on the ground, and players, and I could hear the play-by-play on Westwood One describing what was going on. I had tears in my eyes, not because I personally care for Jamal Williams. I wouldn't recognize the guy if he walked in the library right now, but I get really affected by this now because we know what happens. I will say this. I actually had brunch a few weeks ago with two people who just moved to Boston who are both neuropsychologists. Mm-hmm. And I asked them about trauma and head injuries and CTE. And the female who is, I think she's finished with her PhD and is working here now in brain research, said there is actually conflicting opinions within the neuropsychology community. Some people really do believe in CTE. Others think we don't have enough information. She said, because she said, your brain can recover from a concussion. It can. She said, where the danger lies and where we need to start having more research and do more control groups of people who have participated in something like football, who have participated in something like soccer, and we need to do more research. She said, the one area that is hard to dispute are the subconcussions. concussive hits, and that's why many doctors feel football is more dangerous than other sports. Because yes, you will, you can be on a trampoline and smack your head. You can go up for a rebound in basketball, like Gary Tangway's son, smack your head to the back, and then
happened to her son,
and get a concussion in basketball.
Oh, his son too?
Yes, you can go up and head a ball or collide with someone in the air in soccer and get a concussion. Absolutely, she said. The difference, though. With sports like hockey and football is that you're constantly hitting, and your brain is moving around. She said that is where there is less conflicting opinions on why football is a bigger concern for neuropsychologists.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't want to speak. I'm not sure the people over at BU or the Concussion Legacy Foundation would agree. And
I appreciated her candor. I appreciated that she said, her opinion of saying, listen, she actually said, I don't know exactly where I stand because I need to look at. She said there are good points to be made on either side.
Can I just say one last thing about your statement about Doyle? Because I don't want to get people to have the wrong impression. The guy that was hit. You hear people, Gronkowski a couple of weeks ago when he did his thing,
I asked.
I was out of it. There are a lot of people who describe these incredible hits. No, don't downplay it. They essentially black out at the moment. They don't remember.
Yeah. Right.
Some of them don't even remember the hit much. But having said that, fast forward 20 years and look at some of these guys who've gotten these repeated hits, some of which, as you suggest, subconcussive are not nearly as bad as this. And look at him. This is grotesque. Another, good for the NFL for penalizing this guy from Oakland. But the reality, this is really dangerous stuff.
I mean, it really does come down to the fact that you have to make a choice. You have to make a decision. Football is a dangerous sport. It is a physical sport. And I think we're at a point now where you have to choose. I am, going to choose to allow my son or daughter to play this game, or I am not. I am going to choose to watch this game knowing what I know about it, similar with boxing or MMA or anything else, or I'm not. And that's, I think, where we're at.
So nice job for the NFL, as Jim said. We almost criticize them. It's nice
we do criticize them a lot. So they did make a right decision here.
I think Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, has made a right decision allowing NCAA athletes to be paid.
Well, I don't think he went that far.
Well, it's not quite that far. They are allowed to accept endorsements and hire agents.
Right.
So right
Get
now,
money,
if you
said.
Are an NCAA athlete, and let's say you are, and LeBron James was there at the signing of this bill yesterday.
It was his show he signed
yeah,
it on.
Yeah, it was his show. What is it, like Unfiltered or
Whatever
Undisputed?
It's, called,
it's one of those like athlete-owned websites. So what you can do is, let's say I would have been a really great track and cross country runner in college, and I ran at BC, and New Balance said, wow, she's a really talented athlete. We think she's going to probably run after college. Hey, we're going to sign you. We already sponsor Boston College, and I'm making this up. I don't know if New Balance sponsors Boston College. It's just, I'm trying to make it local. Hey, Trenny, we think you're better than all of the other runners on your team. We think you have a future in distance running. So we're gonna make you a sponsorship athlete. We're going to feature you in ads. We're gonna give you extra, shoes and apparel, and we're gonna give you an endorsement deal while you're in college. Right now, a college athlete outside of California, they can't do it in California until 2023. I'd have to say, I'm sorry, I'm an amateur athlete. I either have to leave my college team and become a professional runner, or I can't accept that endorsement money. Now I could say, in California in 2023, when this goes through, I could say, yeah, New Balance, I would love to be a sponsored athlete by you. I'd love to make money, off of my likeness. I'm helping my team win championships. I have a chance to make this a career after college. I'm going to start earning money now.
But can I tell
you? That's the difference.
When I said that Newsom didn't go far enough, by the way, he's gone farther than anybody else. So, I mean, credit for that. My concern about this thing is the people he is helping are the people who don't need help, because they're the ones most likely to go from college if they're celebrated and play pros. The people, in my opinion, who need help and should be paid are the average athlete on in these huge schools, like an Ohio State football player, for example, or a Wisconsin football player, something like that, who's not going to make it to the pros. But essentially, what he is getting out of college, and it's mostly he's getting out of college, is the free ride for the football team or whatever it is. They're probably not getting a fabulous education. They're the ones who are really screwed by this NCAA.
And that's the people who don't agree with this and who feel like it's not necessarily Oh, wow.
It's a little bit of breaking news.
Why don't you say what it is, Rose, since no one's here except our audience.
The police officer who opened the door into her neighbor's apartment, believing it was her own, and killed the Botham Jean, the man that was sitting there, was just found guilty of murder.
Amber Geiger.
Yeah, I'm not sure what town this was in.
Dallas, I believe.
So that is unusual.
That is huge.
You don't often
also a big deal because the judge in his or her instructions to the jury, as I was discussing with you before the show, allowed the defense to use the Castle Doctrine where you can protect yourself in your own home, even though it wasn't her own home. And she suggested, and by the way, she was a white cop and
he was black.
Was a black
and
man.
Apparently he was sitting on a couch or a chair eating some ice cream.
In his own
and
house.
And she walked in thinking it was her house. That's her story.
Yes. In any case, back to this. So is the sense, I know this only happened, I guess he signed the law yesterday, whenever he did. Is the feeling this begins to open the door so that there are negotiations with the NCAA to do something?
I mean, it's complex. I read the whole ESPN article, and I'll be honest, I had to like read some parts of it twice because it was very confusing to me. I mean, there's a lot of conflicting thoughts on this. Some people feel like, yes, this is a great opportunity. You know, one of the sponsoring legislators on it said this is great for female athletes who don't have the opportunity to play high-level NFL, NBA, MLB sports where you're going to make millions of dollars. So now if you are a runner or a volleyball player or a swimmer, someone with bigger aspirations, maybe Olympic aspirations, professional running, WNBA, you have a chance to maybe make some more money earlier, get your name out there on that sponsorship earlier. Others say what Jim just said, no, this is only going to benefit male, high-profile male athletes whose likenesses the university is already using. There's also some people feel that it's going to help California schools in recruiting, that they are now going to be able to recruit all of the best athletes because they'll be able to know they'll be able to go there. But the NCAA may say, well, I'm sorry, your athletes in California are not amateur athletes. They are professional athletes. So now you can't compete in NCAA championships. At the end of the day, this is going to go to a court. This is going to be the NCAA will file an injunction on this. They will take it to court. This is long from far from being over.
Let me ask you a stupid question. So we often talk about how a lot of these big-time schools, except for the Catholic schools, by the way, have lousy graduation rates, that a lot of these great athletes don't graduate. So why go the route of the endorsements and hiring agents? Why not say, as Jim said, we'll give you a minimum salary? I remember reading stories about how some of these kids are so poor, they're in the Final Four, and they can't afford to have their families come out and watch them play because they can't afford
to. By the way, Derek Jackson, formerly of the Globe, did that brilliant grid for the NCAA basketball championship, not based on their traditional rankings, but based upon graduation rate. It was men and women.
It
was brilliant.
It does seem that would – why did you do it this way? Do you know?
Because I think, one, this is an easier way. It also does not, my guess is, and it didn't really explain it in the article, so this is just me making my best educated guess. One, if you're going to pay athletes within the school, that's going to add, especially to your state schools, to your budgets, right? So you're going to need more taxpayer dollars going into these state schools. If you're a private school, are you going to have to charge more tuition? How are you going to come up with that money?
That's obviously the answer. It doesn't cost them anything. I hadn't thought about it until just now. It basically says you can profit. You can make money off the selling of your image.
Right,
so it isn't like they've got to take money out of their treasury.
It doesn't cost the universities any money. So I would guess that's why. To me, this is a conversation, and we could do a whole half hour with callers on this. I have, as I've traveled more and met more people that weren't born and raised in the United States, I hate the way that we have monetized college sports. Other countries do not do it. The emphasis is on education. You may play. You know, that doesn't mean that you don't go to a college. You don't go to Oxford or Cambridge to play rugby or something. You know, that you don't go to a great university in Canada to play baseball. But there's a reason so many high-level athletes often come to the United States to go to school to play sports, because here it's higher profile. You get a scholarship. You don't get those scholarships in other countries. We have prioritized in this country, and not just in collegiate sports, at the high school and the Pop Warner and the young levels, all the way, if you look at Olympic athletes who start when they're really young, we have prioritized sports and winning over education. We don't care if a poor kid in a socioeconomically disadvantaged area, whether it's a white kid in the Appalachians or a African-American kid in the inner city, if you're really good at sports but you're not great at school, we're going to pass you through the underbelly of everything.
And you better make it to the pros or you're screwed.
And you better make it to the pros or you're screwed. They don't care, because if you bring that state football title to your high school, then you've done what they care about, because then you can put a banner up when you drive into your town. When I drive into my hometown back in Wisconsin, there isn't anything that says we've had this many whatever kind of scholars. It's state champion wrestling, state champion football, state champion girls cross country. We adore sports in this country to a level where education suffers.
Okay, Trent Kuznarek, I'm going to skip ahead to a great story because it's a local story and we missed it last week about this
this
Michael Perino down in Mashpee, who had a congenital disease where he didn't develop arms where he should. He's basically got no arms.
Yes.
But tell us about his dreams and what happened with him.
So he wants to coach pro basketball someday. And it was something he's always been involved in it, obviously, because of the physical birth defects he has. He's not able to play basketball. So he wants to coach it. He's interested in it. And he never really had like a role model to look up to. And then this year at the ESPYs, there was another coach, a football coach with a similar birth defect to him, who won the Arthur Ashe Courage Award.
Yeah, Ron Mendez.
It's amazing.
No arms, no legs.
He goes around in a motorized wheelchair and he coaches football. And he gave this stirring, amazing speech telling kids that, you know, your limitations are only so far as what you believe them to be. And this kid is like, yeah, why not? So now this kid is going to, I believe, help coach the junior varsity team.
Assistant coach
at Mashpee High School. And he's like, in his mind, and why can't he do it? His mom says, oh, you should be a broadcaster. You know so much about sports. And he said, no, mom, I don't want to just be a broadcaster. I want to be like the next Brad Stevens. And you know what? Good for you. You should be, because it doesn't matter. Brad Stevens never, you know, played in the NBA.
We should give credit to the
This
Globe
was written
report.
By Nat Weitzer, and it was in the Globe September 23rd. That's why I wanted to get it to today, because we missed it last week. It's such an uplifting story. And his mother talks about how the kid never was a complainer and how they thought he was never going to be able to walk at all. But now he has some operation. And now he's been walking around the cul-de-sac where they live down in Mashpee. It's a really uplifting piece.
I mean, to me, it's like we need all sorts of different voices and different people and different, you know, viewpoints. And just because you weren't able to play college or pro basketball certainly doesn't mean you don't have the mind for it and the aptitude to be an incredible coach.
By the way, we only have a couple of seconds left. I just want you to know, just so you don't feel you're alone in watching this Brewers Nationals game, playoff game tonight, I'm going to be knitting during because apparently that's what people are doing to get through endless, endless slow baseball.
I saw
games.
This story and I was like, oh, we have to talk about this with Jim and Marjorie. And I had
seconds.
To share it with everybody in my office who complains about baseball. So I think it was the Washington Post that did, or the New York Times. The headline was baseball's pace of play is perfect for knitters. So they have stitch and
that's
pitch.
What I'm doing
you
tonight.
Can go
stitch and pitch.
You can
that's
go. What's you can go knit at a baseball game, and people will finish entire blankets.
I loved it. It's
I'm
great
making
piece.
You mittens, by the way, for the winter
oh,
tonight
thank
during
you
the game.
Very much,
if I have time, I'll make
what
you a pair
socks?
Too.
You're such. You gave me
I'll
socks.
I'll do those tomorrow.
Before.
Next game.
Yeah.
Good to see you, Trenny. We'll be back at noon. Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, is the city of Boston sweeping something under the rug with Operation Clean Sweep? The ACLU of Massachusetts has filed a lawsuit seeking information about the city's actions, which resulted in 34 arrests, displacing and damaging property along the way. In a couple of minutes, we'll talk to Matt Siegel, the ACLU's legal director, about this and more. It's lunchtime. Do you know where your cold cuts are? New nutritional guidelines are saying we don't need to cut back on red meat or processed meats after all. We don't? Is this great news for carnivores, bad news for everyone who's invested in Beyond Meat? Food writer, Corby Comer joins us for this and more.
So it's been a year since columnist Jamal Khashoggi was murdered, and Saudi officials insisted it was a rogue operation. In a new Frontline documentary, Martin Smith investigates what really happened. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Yeah.
Eastern Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We're broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So over the summer, when a Suffolk County House of Corrections officer was attacked in the South End, Boston Police Department responded with Operation Clean Sweep, a patrol along Mass Ave and Melnia Cass Boulevard. They ended up arresting 34 people, damaging some property, and displacing the homeless. Some South End residents says this was long overdue. Some activists challenged that it stigmatized substance abusers. The ACLU of Massachusetts said that public safety has to be protected, but not at the cost of people's basic legal rights. Concerned about the so-called sweep and the lack of transparency about the city's actions, according to them, the ACLU filed a lawsuit against the city asking for more information. Joining us to talk about this and other headlines at the intersection of civil liberties and policy is Matt Siegel. Matt's the legal director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Matt, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
Hey, Matt, thank you very much for coming in. So the ACLU has filed a lawsuit against the city of Boston. What's that about?
So the lawsuit didn't just start with the complaint. It started back in August where, as Jim said, there were these actions called Clean Sweep. And what we did after those actions is we sent a letter to the mayor of Boston saying, looks like there are some serious problems here. We're hearing reports about collective punishment. We're hearing reports about people having their items confiscated and possibly crushed in garbage trucks. And this is raises serious concerns about people's rights and about the right way to go about dealing with people experiencing homelessness. That letter included a public records request, and what happened after we sent that is the city gave us only a few kind of emails in response that didn't really get to the heart of our concerns and didn't seem to provide any context for how this operation suddenly emerged immediately after, as Jim said, this incident involving a correction officer. And so because we didn't get a satisfactory response, we filed a public records lawsuit to get to the bottom of what really happened and also to help us understand whether there have been serious violations of people's rights.
And by the way, when you talk about serious violations of people's rights, I think we've just, at least I discussed this with Rachel Rollins, Suffolk County DA. We discussed it with the mayor, I think with John Santiago the other day, who's both the doctor of the emergency room doc at BMC right in the neighborhood and a state representative. Is your basic contention that there's some people who committed no crime, their only, quote, crime was that they were homeless and happened to be there, that they were swept up by the whole thing? Is that the concern?
That's a core concern. I mean, if somebody in one of our neighborhoods commits a crime, we would not expect the police to come swooping in and ransack our communities. And, you know, the law doesn't apply differently when the people involved are people who are experiencing homelessness. If anything, they deserve more sympathy. And what we're seeing here are reports of collective punishment. Something bad happened, and we go in and we, you know, make some noise and throw people's, you know, there's reports of people's wheelchairs being thrown in garbage trucks.
You know, how much of this is about the fact that because there's this terrible tragedy with both homelessness and opioid addiction, and a lot of people used to be out in Long Island, and so they weren't in the South End, and you have a lot of high-end houses now down in the South End. How much of this is just that neighbors going bananas over people sitting on their stoop or whatever, a conflict between the homeless people who don't have homes, obviously, and have to go somewhere, and the people in the South End who are ticked off?
Well, I'd say two things about that. The first is that if there's some evidence that there was a good reason for this, that's why you file a public records request and you'd expect to see some kind of justification for it. We haven't seen that. But the second thing is, I think that, you know, one of the reasons why this is such an important issue for the ACLU Massachusetts is that we're not going to solve any societal problems by just ransacking communities and ransacking streets. It's going to be about the delivery of better services to people who need them, whether it's housing or drug treatment or whatever it might be. It's not going to be in bringing garbage trucks to a neighborhood and telling everyone to scram.
By the way, in defense, we had this discussion with the mayor. I think the mayor would totally agree with you in that regard. I mean, my sense as an outsider is that the police just overreacted here because essentially one of their own. I don't mean to minimize the significance of this thing, but at the same time that you're doing this, virtually all the players involved are, I think, working pretty hard to try to fix the problem too. I mean, the mayor and Santiago both want the bridge to be built in Long Island, and there's unfortunately the mayor of Quincy who's standing in the way of this. Pine Street. We did a thing with them last week trying to build more housing as fast as they can. So, again, I'm not letting anybody off the hook because I don't know what the bottom line is here until you get what you're looking for. But I don't get the sense that there was intent, which does not minimize what the consequence may have been. But don't you really think it was because the Suffolk County corrections officer was there and they plunged in without a huge amount of forethought? Isn't that what it seems to be like?
Well, that may be what happened, but there's a concern that that would make it sort of worse rather than better.
Because there was inadequate planning?
Right. I mean,
I have no idea if I'm right.
Not just that it was inadequate planning, but it was acting out of anger rather than a sincere desire to help either the people who were affected by the operation or the people, as Marjorie points out, in the neighboring community. Was this really for anyone's benefit, or was this because people were mad?
Well, I should probably keep my mouth shut, because I'm acting as if I may have no idea, and so we'll continue the conversation, and we'll continue to monitor what you're doing. You know, Matt, as Carol, your boss, Carol Rose, knows, I think Marjorie and I agree, of all the sadism that has come out of this administration, the worst of this administration being Washington, has been on the immigration front and families and this sort of thing. Before you talk about the litigation you're involved in against the acting head of one piece of the immigration system, this Ken Cuccinelli guy, explain what the medical deferred action program is that the Trump administration has decided to terminate.
Yeah, so we've certainly been involved in a number of issues, family separation, travel ban, and this has got to be up there as one of the worst actions we've seen. So what deferred action is, it's a program whereby the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services can offer defer any action on someone's immigration situation, which means that even if they don't have status in this country, they're not going to be deported. And when you get deferred action status, you can even apply for work authorization in this country. And that has become a vital program for people with serious medical needs, individuals and families who cannot really leave this country without that risking becoming a death sentence. And so what we learned in August was that without any public fanfare or announcement, USCIS completely terminated this deferred action program, and the way people found out about it is that they started to get letters. People with serious illnesses, people who need to stay in this country to stay alive, got letters saying, you don't get this relief, we've ended the program, and you have 33 days to leave the country. It was awful.
And I'm assuming, based upon history, that these were mostly not white people. Is that a safe assumption, or am I being unfair?
It's always a safe assumption when you're talking about the Trump administration. So, yes, I mean, so in the lawsuit that we ended up filing, we represent the Irish International Immigrant Center, which helps a lot of these folks and which helps them with their applications. But notwithstanding the name, nearly all of their clients are people of color from places like Central and South America or Africa or the Caribbean. And so we don't think, and our complaint says, that it was no accident that the Trump administration chose to terminate a program that was primarily benefiting people of color.
And is there a stay? Have you gotten a stay in this thing? Is there a stay on the expulsions pending your resolution of your litigation, or no?
Well, what we've gotten is some degree of buckling on the part of the Trump administration. After the lawsuit was filed in early September, there was a congressional hearing, which was kind of remarkable because USCIS sent a representative to testify at this hearing, and he said because of our lawsuit, he wasn't going to tell Congress what the program now is, why it was terminated, or what anyone's reasons for doing anything were, which is unreal.
What was his excuse? Pending litigation? Is that
what
he said?
He said it was on the advice of counsel. I've met lawyers. That's not the kind of advice I see them give. But what happened after this lawsuit, and there's been intense public pressure, Ken Cuccinelli, who's the acting director of USCIS,
Citizenship and Immigration Services,
yeah. Issued a letter saying that they were going to begin going back to how things were before they terminated the program. Now, it remains to be seen whether that's something we can take seriously, but it sounds like they're saying they're rescinding what they did.
By the way, if you're listening, you're saying, I know that name, Cuccinelli. The reason you know it is probably not because he was the Attorney General of Virginia. You know him because of his comments on CNN and NPR in August. This is Cuccinelli first seemingly quoting Emma Lazarus' poem during an interview with Morning Edition on NPR, then telling Erin Burnett on CNN that the poem was written during the same time as America's first public charge rule. Here's Ken Cuccinelli.
They certainly are. Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge.
That poem was referring back to people coming from Europe where they had class-based societies where people were considered wretched if they weren't in the right class. And it was introduced, it was written 1 year, 1 year after the first federal public charge rule was written that says, and I'll quote it, any person unable to take care of himself without becoming a public charge, unquote, would be inadmissible. Or in the terms that my agency deals with, they can't do what's called adjusting status, getting a green card, becoming legal permanent residents.
Essentially saying, give me your tired and poor if they're from Norway. That is essentially what he was saying.
So it was terrible at the time, but it's even more sort of chilling in hindsight because that was, as you said, Jim, in August. So he was giving those remarks at the very same time, more or less, that his agency was sending out these letters terminating the program. We didn't know at the time, but now it makes even more sense that he was eliminating a program that about people who need our help, who need America's grace, at the very same time that he was saying, you know, we like people from Europe.
You know, I'm asking you as a speculator and opinion, but which I know is not your forte, but I'll ask you anyway. I've always wondered if there's anything that most people feel tremendous empathy for, it's animals. And then I think in second place, unfortunately, sick children. You know, we feel very bad for sick children. So you wonder how, whether the kid is from Kenya or Ghana or El Salvador, I should say, and they've got cerebral palsy or they've got some terrible cancer. What was the thinking here? I mean, do you have any knowledge of why they thought this was a good place to go so all these kids could be on TV crying about how they're going to have to go home to die?
Well, it really is that bad. I mean, and the bravery that's been showed by some of these families, like the Sanchez family, the young boy who has cystic fibrosis,
yes.
He testified in Congress. You know, he had the bravery to go in front of Congress and testify as to the truth. The USCIS person said, I can't tell you anything. But we're talking about, you know, a kid with eye cancer, a woman who's got incurable breast cancer. I mean, these are really horrible stories. I mean, I can't obviously look into the hearts of the people who are making these decisions, but I can say consistently, whether it's the Muslim ban or family separation or this termination of deferred action, what we're seeing is that an administration that never does the responsible, humane, or moral thing unless people make them change.
Okay, so let's bring it back home here. And you have litigation against the police department. I think it was originally started against Commissioner Evans, and I bring him up because we've actually discussed this litigation with him before he gave way, left for BC, and Willie Gross took over, about the ability, if I understand it correctly, Matt Siegel, it's about the ability of an individual to videotape or to photograph an officer while he or she is doing their work in a public place. Is that a fair characterization of what it is?
That's right.
And my understanding, and Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought when we discussed this with Commissioner Evans, when you guys first filed this thing, I thought he said it was on the air that, of course, people can do this. He may have qualified and said we're not crazy about it at all times or we don't want to obviously get in the way of our doing our jobs, and I'm assuming there's some prescription about that, too. But I assume this had been agreed to. Obviously, if my recollection is right, I am wrong.
Well, our true beef here is really with a state law, and that maybe gets at what Commissioner Evans
What is the state
so
law?
So we had to sue Commissioner Evans and now Commissioner Gross and the district attorney in order to get at this law. But what it is there's a First Amendment right, which has been recognized by an appellate court that governs this area, that everyone has a right to record police officers performing their duties in public. There is a state law in Massachusetts that says you can't record anybody, which includes police officers, if your recording is secret. That is unknown to them. So what we're doing...
It's a second two-party consent. Is that what the law says there?
It actually doesn't even require consent. In other words, if I take out a camera right now and start recording you and you say stop, I'm not violating the law if I keep going. It just says that I'm supposed to notify you that I'm doing it.
Okay.
And so what we're saying is that because there's this fundamentally important First Amendment right to record police officers performing their duties in public, our clients who are two activists say we shouldn't need to do it openly. In fact, if we do it openly, that may put us at harm's way in certain police situations. And so what they're saying is, and what we're asking a court to say, is that this law is unconstitutional. We initially sued on behalf of our clients, the commissioner, as you say, Jim, and the district attorney. We won in the district court, the trial level court, and the Boston Police Department did not appeal. Oh. So that's consistent with the conversation you had. But the district attorney has appealed, so now we're going to the appellate court.
Who's the district attorney?
Rachel Rollins.
Well, that, is, to me, is shocking. I mean, what is Rollins' public... we've never discussed it with her, but it's sort of... she's a big transparency kind of person. What's her public reasoning for opposing this thing?
Well, you know, everyone has a job to do here in Massachusetts, and, you know, we sometimes agree with District Attorney Rollins, and sometimes we disagree. But, you know, regardless...
it helped her get elected with that campaign. What a difference a DA makes.
Well, that was not the focus of the campaign or the goal of the campaign.
That it was, but, I think, part the consequence, whether it was intentional or not. But go ahead.
But I think this illustrates the point that just because we sometimes agree with the district attorney does not mean we have a preferred candidate or a preferred
person.
No,
but my point is she doesn't have to defend a law. There are situations through the years here where attorneys general of the state have not defended a particular law that that was a state law and there had to be a special counsel or whatever. She doesn't have to defend the law, does she? I mean, I haven't spoken to her, so I have no idea what the basis for this is. It may be sort of pro forma, but I'm sort of surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know all the reasons, but I can say that, you know, what the outcome of that decision is that we're going to get a ruling that will hopefully decide once and for all whether this is a law that anyone in Massachusetts can be enforcing as against police the recording of police officers performing their duties in public.
This is a little confusing to me, too, so I hope you can straighten me out. We're talking with the ACLU's Matt Siegel. We've had these couple of cases now in which people that work for these drug labs have, in fact, had drug problems themselves and falsifying records.
Sort of the understatement of the century, I should say.
Okay.
A little bit.
Well, for many years, thousands of records.
Thousands of cases.
Case of the Sonia Farrick, who apparently worked for 8 years for the state drug lab and was stealing samples and getting high and testing evidence while under the influence and throwing all these cases into question, as the story reads. But there's a dispute about the time here. Is that what's going on? That the Attorney General's office is arguing that this only went on for 5 months and... when in fact she was there for 8 years. So what's going on here?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. There were two scandals, one involving Andy Dukin, who was sort of inventing test results, which is a nice way of saying framing people. And there was Sonia Farrick, who was actually using the drugs because she was herself suffering from an addiction and was choosing to feed that addiction at work.
Right.
What happened after Farrick's misconduct was caught, after she was arrested, which was January 2013, there were all these things that prevented people from getting justice. So, you know, we represent two people, Herschel Reeves and Nicole Westcott, who's sitting with collateral consequences of drug convictions. You know, they can affect people's ability to get jobs and housing and all these things. And what happened after Farrick was arrested, this goes to the timing issue, first there was essentially a cover-up of Farrick's misconduct by two people who used to work for the Attorney General's office, which delayed everyone finding out how bad it was. And then there were disputes, as you say, about how long it went on and how many cases it affected. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts resolved those questions in an October 2018 ruling, throwing out every case that ever had Sonia Farrick's name on it, plus every methamphetamine case that ever went through the lab where she worked while she was there, plus any drug case of any kind that went through the Amherst drug lab where Farrick worked from like January 29th, 2009 until her arrest. So a lot of cases. And what just happened is we got a report from a special master appointed by the court to keep track of all this. And what he's reporting is that all those cases added up to over 24,000 dismissed drug charges in the Farrick scandal across at least 16,449 different cases. So that's a lot just in Farrick.
That's a lot.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's on top of the Dukin scandal, which resulted in part by the work of the ACLU Massachusetts and the public defenders and pro bono lawyers in the single largest dismissal of wrongful convictions in the nation's history, which was over 36,000 charges across 21,000 okay. exchange cases.
And is it, are they both still in jail, do you know, or do you know?
No, I think Anna Dukin's out.
No, she's out?
Yeah, I think they're so. Yeah. Do we ever have any idea? I guess Farrakh, she had a problem with
drugs.
But what was the other one doing? I mean, that's a little odd. Dukin. Did anybody ever find out why she was doing this?
Well, she's been described in media reports as sort of a serial confabulator, and you know, someone who just couldn't help herself by making herself seem like she was being more productive than she was. Of course, she was never reported as being productive in favor of the defense. It was always to help the prosecution. So I don't know if we've ever gotten to the bottom of that. But I think what these two cases together show is that this war on drugs in Massachusetts has been sort of done on the cheap. I mean, it's one thing for people to appear and to do bad things, but for the system to allow that to happen means we were really not paying attention.
Do we have, very quickly, because we're out of time, do we have any idea of the tens of thousands of cases that were dismissed? Do we have any idea how many of the defendants in those cases had to do jail time because of this phonied up reports from these two women?
Oh, a lot. A lot of people. And one of the
A lot
things,
mean thousands? Low thousands?
Probably thousands upon thousands served their sentences. And the problem was the scandals took so long to uncover that most of them had already served their sentences.
So are they getting any compensation for this or no?
Well, two things. One is we're hoping that lifting these convictions from their records will allow them to more easily move on with their lives. And the other
so the
is...
the convictions haven't even been lifted yet from their
well,
records?
Well, now they have.
Now they have.
But the other is it's a class action lawsuit to try to help them recover all the fines and fees that we extract from poor criminal defendants in Massachusetts. But the easiest way to avoid these problems, of course, is to limit our prosecution of drug crimes in the first place. That's how you don't have
fair enough, Matt. Thanks so
thank
much.
Thank you very
Good
much,
to see
Matt
you.
Siegel. Matt Siegel is legal director for the ACLU of Massachusetts. Great to talk to you, Matt. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, how New England's lobster industry is getting caught up in the U.S.-China trade war. Corby Kummer joins us for that and with news on meat eating. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. McDonald's is the latest fast food enterprise to give new meaning to the Nothing Burger. The Golden Arches will be testing a plant-based patty in Canada. And speaking of Nothing Burger, this is unbelievable. Is all our hand-wringing about the hazards of eating red and processed meats in vain? New guidelines suggest it may have been, but should these guidelines be trusted? Join us to cover these and other headlines about food policy and food culture as food writer Corby Kummer. Corby's the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hello, Corby Kummer.
Hello.
Hello, Corby Kummer. Well, I personally have signed off any of these food studies because, you know, first coffee is going to kill you, then it's not going to kill you, then it's low fat, then it's high
this
fat,
is
then
big,
it's butter,
though, Marjorie.
Then it's margarine. Okay, you may say it's big. I'm very suspicious of them all. But now this new study by something I never heard of, the Annals of Internal Medicine, says that... keep eating all the red meat. They have been quickly criticized by everybody else, American Heart Association, Cancer Society, T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard University, et cetera. So do we know who's right here?
Yeah. All of us who've been saying red meat is disastrous for the environment, probably not good for your health, very bad for methane gas and climate change, are right. That's who's right.
Yeah, but that's an evasive answer. I knew you were going to say that. The answer
you
is...
You are. Rudy Giuliani over there.
No, it's really important. Well, half of what you said is totally true. This report is not suggesting that the climate change implications, which we've discussed with you ad nauseum, are not as severe. What the report is saying is that the evidence is not as clear as many respected nutritionists and food science people have suggested. My biggest concern here, beyond whoever you think is right, is this will feed, and I don't mean that as a pun, this will feed the Marjorie Egans of the world who say, you can't trust any of these people. As she says, remember butter was on the front page, what was it, Time Magazine or Newsweek or something? Then it was no butter.
Then
it's red and processed meat,
you're
going to kill you and give you cancer.
And saccharin.
How does an average person, I mean this sincerely, who does not have your credentials,
of course,
who's reading the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, watching television, listening to us today, how the hell do they know who's telling the truth and what to do?
So this is merchants of doubt. 101. I went to bed last night after reading the Times story saying, I hope Jim doesn't see this. And then I woke up and I thought, you know, it's really billed high and he's going to see it. And indeed,
even
Chelsea wrote me and said, we're doing this. Why was I so angry and upset? Because Gina Colata, a reporter at the Times who...
Forever, right?
Forever and forever reviled for her AIDS reporting on HIV. And because my pals in the community thought she should have been severely reprimanded,
What'd she do wrong?
She would jump on findings and skew them. Now, I'm saying this without having looked into the details, dug up what my friends had to say. I kept out of it because unless I was a fact checker, I was going and looking, and I'm not an HIV scientist. I didn't know. I just knew that my pals whom I relied on didn't like her reporting. So here I am smearing her with no firsthand knowledge, for which I apologize. But I read this and steam came out of my ears.
Oh, by the way, she didn't do the research. I read it in the Washington Post,
but let me tell you the way she played it.
The Annals of Internal Medicine. Who are they?
No, Annals of Internal Medicine is a big serious, important journal.
Yeah. Okay.
But here's the way she played it, the way a reporter wants to. They raise uncomfortable questions about dietary advice.
She's right.
Harvard T. Chan School of Public Health and the American Heart Association, the American Cancer Society, huge important groups, have savaged the findings in the journal that published them. So as soon as you read that, you think, I'm going to go straight for those findings because I'm for the underdog and I'm for the truth in journalism. So while we're just talking about this, let's tell people what this is about. So this is about looking at a whole bunch of observational studies of people who eat red meat and saying, as opposed to people who don't, and saying, did they get more cancer? Did they get more heart disease? How robust and strong is the evidence? And finding that it was weak. And any time you look at these observational studies, as opposed to the kind of causal, you lock people up in a room and you give them red meat, you lock people up and you don't give them red meat.
But you can't realistically do that here.
That's exactly the problem. So the minute you want to go in to figure out, you know, the minute you want to go in and say, the meat industry hates this, how am I going to find evidence that red meat isn't so bad? You go in, you gather a whole bunch of studies, and you make them say what you want. Now, I'm saying that because I once did a four-hour seminar at Harvard with a bunch of national health researchers about saturated fat, which red meat is full of saturated fat. And one by one, attacked these big meta-studies. Meta-studies take lots and lots of studies that have been over the years and say, what are the trends here? What can we really see? And they all said to me, they can be just as biased as an individual study. And that's what I felt seeing this. But
you don't know, Corby, you don't know that it's
no,
biased.
No, I'm not.
This is a credible operation here. And by the way, I would err on the side that you are erring on the side. Let me read. This is Associated Press. It's not Gina
Colata.
Please
do. Yeah.
Eating red meat is linked to cancer and heart disease, but are the risks big enough to give up burgers and steak? A team of international researchers says probably not. Contradicting established advice in a series of papers published Monday. Researchers say the increased risks are small and uncertain, and that cutting back likely would not be worth it for people who enjoy meat. So again, you know, in that Harvard thing you did for 4 hours, arguably everybody in that room has the level of skill and experience to make an informed decision. Mm-hmm. But I think this thing is an unmitigated disaster for the American public. I don't mean about red meat. I mean about everything. Because most people are going to catch a snippet of this on the evening news and sort of say...
Forget the whole thing.
Eat what you like because they're all full of it. I mean, doesn't that worry you?
Absolutely. And that's why I could barely go to sleep thinking of Jim getting his hands on this story.
I had a salami sandwich for breakfast, by the way.
But of course the public is going to. There are a lot of lessons to bring from this. One is this is merchants of doubt. I really want to know who funded this study, even though they say we did not have conflicts of interest. We were not funded by the meat industry. As my pal Marion Nestle in foodpolitics.com said, boy, do I want to know the backstory of this. The other thing is merchants of doubt. It's the same thing with climate change. It was the same thing with smoking. If you find some weak link or you drive a wedge into what seemed to be solid evidence, you are then casting doubt on the entire enterprise. That's what this is doing. And it's ignoring climate change.
Well, that part is totally true.
Well, hold on for a second. One thing I did wonder about, we talked to you a while ago about how everybody used to say, go for the low-fat milk, go for the skim milk. And then that we decided it wasn't so bad to have whole milk, which I have been doing nonstop since I read that initial study. And I thought part of the reason it was okay to have whole milk and whole yogurt is because the link to Dread disease was not as significant as it had been.
I thought it was satiety, too, the other word you taught me. Isn't it satiety part of it as well?
Satiety has so much to do with it. And, Jim, you've really absorbed that word.
I have
and
very
you
well.
Pronounced
satiety.
It right, meaning feeling of fullness.
Right.
And it prevents you.
Well, it
you
does
from,
work.
It prevents you from eating other kinds of calories. But something that you just said from the AP story is true of almost all studies, which is, how do you translate a big group finding to you, Jim Browdy, and you, Marjorie Egan? Yeah. It's very hard to dictate personal choice based on big studies.
Well, I think you just have to be moderate, don't you? You can't eat five cheeseburgers.
Can't?
No, I don't think so. Every day or seven cheeseburgers a week. I mean,
and
isn't that what...
My colleague at Tufts, Alice Lichtenstein, is quoted in the Times story saying something, as she always does, very sensible, which is, so you look at the people who have one hamburger every day or something, they're heavy red meat eaters. Do you think they're having yogurt and salad at lunch? Or do you think they're having a lot of Coca-Cola and French
Meaning
fries?
Meaning it may be Coke and the French fries.
What else are they eating,
exactly.
And what are their dietary habits in general?
But
we don't know.
I can stay with the whole milk and the whole yogurt, correct?
Marjorie, I'm not going to dispense individual advice to you on
and
the radio.
And by the way,
I'm
when you're having the whole milk, have a cheeseburger with it. That's my advice.
All right.
That's
we're
Jim's
Corbin
based
Cummer,
on last night.
Our food guy.
So this does kind of take the wind out of the sails of McDonald's a little bit. It's testing these plant-based burgers in Canada.
Why does it take the wind out
so
of the sails?
So much does not take the wind out of their sails. I'm on a tear today. Why is that? Because the founders of Impossible and Beyond Meat are straight dyed-in-the-wool environmentalists.
Okay.
This was why they founded these companies.
All right.
This is their whole thing. They will not use the V word for vegan. They won't talk about vegetarianism. All they will say is this is better for the planet.
Which is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
thank you, Marjorie. Yeah, it's a big deal.
Looking forward to the plant-based burgers from McDonald's. Okay, let's move on. This is an awful story, speaking of meat, about these prisons in Texas and these meat manufacturers selling all this tainted meat. In one case said this is not to be consumed by human beings.
And by the way, knowing that it was tainted meat.
Doing it on purpose.
Going at off hours, calling in workers late at night so they could essentially circumvent all the regulation, all the inspections,
right,
such as it is, and sell stuff that potentially could be deadly to prisoners there.
It is part of the whole movement in this country to treat prisoners as animals, as refuse, as members of society who don't deserve any kind of humane treatment, which is defeating the whole purpose of the correctional system, which is trying to get people back into society. How in the world do they expect these people to come back in and want to be productive members of society when they've been abused in prison? Which is this. It was paying no attention to food safety for meat that went into prisons, and also one company that said, all right, if the meat, and this is going to gross everybody out, if the meat from hearts has been legal forever in hamburgers, so the actual muscle meat, because as you know, heart is the most powerful muscle in the body, if that muscle can be included in ground meat, but the ventricles, the veins, the aorta, all that stuff can't be. And so one meat company would send people in the night when the inspectors weren't there and say, cut up the valves and put them in. It probably, that part didn't affect food safety. It's just this kind of contempt. And second-class citizens, these people aren't really people.
You know what's really depressing, too, that you read this earlier story when they were selling meat to the prisons in Texas that was not for human consumption. Mm-hmm. They paid a fine. I would guess if that Texas meat processor went to jail.
Exactly. That's exactly
that the
right.
guy that just did it and pled guilty would not have done it. And I think we have to somehow change these laws so that we don't have
to. We discuss this all the time about corporate criminals. They pay fines. It's a cost of doing business. And there's no incentive not to do it again.
Such a low cost.
Imagine what it's going to do to all these Varsity Blues people. Felicity Hoffman, we know, is going for 2 weeks, a short amount of time. And she is on the totem pole, and she expressed great remorse. But some of these millionaires and billionaires are going to be doing 2 months, 3 months, maybe some of them will even do 6 months. Imagine how that will change their perspective on the world.
Wait, especially getting ventricles and aortas.
Well, I don't think they're going to have to worry about that. They're going to be like Jeffrey Epstein prison, don't you think, for the most part?
Jeffrey Epstein was so upset about where he was in prison. He was in a horrible prison in Manhattan. Remember, he spent 12 hours...
No, I'm talking about when he was in Florida for his 13 months of alleged incarceration.
Martha Stewart was in a federal... She was in a federal prison. I don't think it's fun and games.
We're talking to Corby Cummer. Corby, speaking of Donald Trump, were we speaking of Donald Trump? We were at some point today. Tariffs. Chinese tariffs on lobsters coming from the United States, 35%. As a result, lobster imports to China are down 80%, which is obviously very bad news for a lot of business people and fishermen in this neck of the woods. Yes?
Yes, and here you are. You have Vince Mortiaro, owner of Mortiaro Lobster in Gloucester, saying that because his sales to China went down 25%, he had to lay off employees and trim costs. This is better than the two big companies that went under because there's been an 80% drop in a year in lobster exports to China. And this guy in Gloucester is saying, we spent $3 million on infrastructure. 6 months later, we're hit with all these tariffs. It's a bitter pill to swallow. He did not then go on to say, nonetheless, I support President Trump, which is the way the soybean farmers Iowa say, sure, we've lost all our market, but China had it coming. So this has hit home here in New England. Big seafood companies, too, were quoted in this Globe piece as saying that they went under. And, you know, again, in Gloucester, Representative Ann Margaret Ferrante, Democrat in Gloucester, said trade wars are hurting not just lobstermen but other sectors of the seafood industry, processors, wholesalers, supermarkets, and restaurants. We, because we know lobster fishermen and the lobster biz around here, can start seeing, oh, here's all the corollary damage. Here are all the ancillary businesses that are going to get bashed because of these tariffs. Start thinking about it. In the meat, the pork processing industry, pork's gone way down. In soybeans, because Brazil's taking over the world market. These entire towns are going to die because of this useless trade war.
Speaking of climate change, isn't the lobster business around here being badly hurt by the lobsters going to Canada?
You're absolutely right. Because of climate change, the ocean's warming up, and so the most fertile lobster fishing grounds have pretty much moved north to Canada. Yeah.
You know, by the way, I had Nestor Ramos on last night from the Globe, who wrote that piece, the investigative piece the Globe did. He's going to be on with us on the radio in the next couple of days. I'm not
so
sure
upsetting.
Which day. We knew this factoid before, but I had forgotten it. The waters in and around the Cape are warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans and other waterways, just faster than 99%. You know, by the way, we always try to bring you the latest news, breaking news. Someone just emailed me a story that was posted on The Hill, which is one of our favorite sites, a few minutes ago. Reporters scramble after a mouse falls from White House ceiling. And here's the tweet from Peter Alexander, he's the NBC White House correspondent. He says, in other news, he tweeted this, a mouse literally fell out of the ceiling in our White House booth and landed on my lap. So we don't want you to miss that story. Obviously, it's the latest.
A little levity up
out
at the
of, unless it fell on your lap.
We just thought the White House was bugged.
So speaking of bugs, we had a couple of women, young women from Harvard on years and years and years ago, who I looked up this morning. I think, Chelsea, am I right? Six Foods, is that what it was called? I think it was called Six Foods. They were two kids who were young entrepreneurs, and they essentially wanted to create a business where we ate bugs, where we ate insects.
Yeah.
And I think Six Foods is, do insects have six legs or something like that? I think they do.
A
I think that's where it came from. And so now there is a move, I guess, for protein, well, whatever it is, for people to eat more insects. Is that right?
You know this story. This
I do?
This is a long-going story.
Well, I know
it
now.
Yeah, there's a big move to increase Americans' ingestion of insects. Well, the way Mexicans, the way South Americans, the way Africans for millenniums, we're taught to say millenniums, not millennia, have been eating insects and considering them a delicacy, liking their sourish or salty scent, the beetles, the ants in Mexico. It became a trend even, I think, Bondier, I think even Jason Bond was serving crickets on something or ants. You know, human beings, not human beings, Americans don't like it because we've been acculturated to dislike insects and think they're really gross.
And what's the plus again? Was that right? Is it protein or what is the...
Oh, it's clean protein. It's cheap. It's incredibly efficient. It's incredibly easy. You know, it has salt. It has salty crunch.
So since you taught me the word satiety, which I not only hadn't heard, I couldn't pronounce.
But you have to use it three times a day.
How do you pronounce the word for eating?
Entomography.
No, there's no R.
Wait.
There's no R.
Entomophagy.
Entomophagy. Thank you
right.
very much.
Like dirt has phagy at the
end. Are we discussing this because this is picking up steam, this movement in the United States? Or are we discussing it because people like you think it should pick up steam?
I'll tell you why we're discussing it. Because the Times decided they wanted to run a photo feature on it. It is a very popular subject. I remember 2 years ago at Christmas during the wave of books, I got three books about eating insects and how to incorporate them into our diet.
Instead?
Why don't we what?
Eat beans instead. They're not
absolutely.
Bad for the plant. Yeah.
You are full of nutritional advice as well as full of beans.
Excuse me.
What's
the difference in eating an insect and eating a hamburger?
Because the idea of biting into a nice little hornet.
Do you ever have a chocolate ant in your whole life?
When I was a kid on a dare.
Okay.
It was crunchy. Very crunchy.
But I'm serious. What?
Chocolate covered.
So it's the consistency that troubles you or the concept?
It's the concept.
And could you get used to it?
No.
Okay, fine. We're talking to Corby Cummer.
It's the concept. We're programmed in our lives. We're programmed to dislike insects. The Mexicans aren't. Africans aren't.
Why are you making a face?
Because we are programmed to dislike insects. I mean, think about the summer trying to get the ants that were running around your house, right? You had to get the little ant houses and hope they didn't invade all your nice... baked goods you just got from the bakery.
So,
Corby, for anything else?
Yeah, we only have a couple of minutes left. I can't tell you, how many stories have we done with you about the angst that chefs in Europe are suffering over not getting, hoping to get, losing a Michelin star? Didn't a guy kill himself a couple of years ago, and a major chef, because he lost the star, because he was worried about losing a star? Was that
Bernard Voisin?
That's the guy.
Yeah.
And so this guy, from 3-2, 2 is not nothing, is suing because he say the Michelin people, is that how you pronounce it, Michelin or Michelin, whatever it is.
You know, all we care about is how you pronounce the diet.
Exactly.
It's Michelin.
So Michelin is because he thinks they thought that he had cheddar cheese, which is, I assume, a cardinal sin in some dish, rather than what he was supposed to. Is that the basis for this incredibly important lawsuit?
Yeah, he had reblochon, Beaufort, exactly. And Tom. So not like Tom's, but T-O-M-M-E, which is a mountain cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what? He was essentially being accused of putting a foreign cheese, an English cheese, into his... rigorously French and absolutely local cheese souffle. And what he was doing was kind of like what your meat people are doing. He tried to say through this one error the entire system should be distrusted. Oh. They were not accurate about my cheese souffle. So imagine how inaccurate they are around the world in every single review they do.
Can I say, break a little news here. We're going to put a press release. Marjorie and I are filing a friend of the court brief on behalf of the chef in this individual case, because we're upset about the cheddar.
I would like
too.
To also point out that about 5 or 6 emailers immediately emailed to tell me that they suspect that the mouse that fell from the ceiling in the White House is, in fact, a rat.
Ba-dum-bum. Thank you,
Corby,
very much.
Corby, thank you very much.
Corby, nice to see you.
Corby's executive director of the Food and Science Society Policy at Aspen Institute, a senior editor at The Atlantic, and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Thank you, Corby. Up next, a year after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered, Frontline's Martin Smith investigates. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan broadcasting from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Tomorrow will be 1 year since Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. The killing prompted outrage around the world and increased scrutiny of Mohammed bin Salman. In the new Frontline documentary, The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman tells Martin Smith that he gets all the responsibility for the murder because it happened on his watch. Nonetheless, the Crown Prince maintains he had no prior knowledge of Khashoggi's murder, and Saudi officials are adhering to the narrative this was a rogue operation. Frontline's The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia airs tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 Central on PBS, and is now streaming on pbs.org/frontline. Martin, congratulations yet again, and good to talk to you.
It's good to be back on your show.
Yeah,
thank
great
you.
Great to talk to you too, Martin. So before we get to the murder and your great reporting about conditions over there in Saudi Arabia, tell us a little bit about how the guy a lot of us just call MBS, this Crown Prince, rose to power, because there are a lot of princes over there to compete with. How did he rise?
Yeah, there are about 15,000 princes.
Is that many? I did not know that.
Well, the founder of the kingdom, King Abdulaziz Al Saud, he had about 100-some-odd children, and half of those were boys. And out of those, we've had all the kings to date.
Wow.
And then Mohammed bin Salman is the son of the King Salman, who was a son of the founder, is a son of the founder, and he came and became king in 2015, and he put Mohammed bin Salman, his favorite son apparently, or at least the one son he thought would be best at the job of running the country, in the line of succession immediately. He made him minister of defense, and he made him deputy crown prince. So at the age of 29, young Prince Mohammed was just, second in line to become the king. And you know, there you have it. He was the oldest son of his third marriage and spent a lot of time with his dad kind of learning the ropes.
And he amassed power in an incredibly quick manner for someone still pretty young.
Yeah, he drew a lot of attention. He drew a lot of attention. First of all, his war in Yemen was more or less sold to the Saudi people and to the world as being a quick operation. It hasn't turned out that way. It's become known as MBS's war. But that put him on the map, for better or worse. He also began to talk about a whole host of reforms. And about a year after he became Deputy Crown Prince, he announced this Vision 2030, which is to diversify the economy away from oil. Up until not so long ago, 90% of all the income for Saudi Arabia was from oil. He wanted to diversify the economy and open it up to foreign investment. He wanted to have a big IPO of Saudi Aramco to raise money to build the new infrastructure, high-speed trains, robotic cities, all of this. And so this got a lot of attention, and a lot of people were very impressed with his energy and charisma. It's very different than the sort of octogenarian kings that we've seen in recent years. He was a young guy in his, 30, 31 years old. He's now 34. The problem, of course, was that that wasn't all there was to him.
But the self-marketing, Martin, was brilliant. You know, when you tell the story of him coming to America and he's celebrated by all of our great celebrities and leaders.
Yeah, name a few.
You'd name a few.
Jeff Bezos, Madeleine Albright, Tom Friedman from the New York Times, Oprah.
Oprah, right.
A lot of tech people, as you talk about, really thought he was fantastic.
Was the celebration because we didn't do our... Because I fell prey to that, too, to tell the truth. Was that because we didn't do our homework or because he was so good at self? I mean, as an example, we talk a lot on the show last week, Martin, about can the Democrats convey a simple but honest message to the American people about the alleged high crimes of and misdemeanors of the President of the United States? What everybody in America, I remember, was talking about, he's going to let women drive. It's simple. It's to the point. There's obviously a backstory. We'll get to you within a couple of minutes. But how were we so easily fooled when America seemed to have fallen in love with the guy when he visited?
I think it is as simple as we believed what we wanted to believe about him. And there's no doubt that he came as a reformer. He was interested in economic loosening, of opening up the country to outsiders. He's making a big show right as we speak as to making this a major tourist destination in the world. But all of this, of course, got confused with the idea of political reform. Economic, social reforms, allowing women to drive, does nothing for people that want to be able to write what they want to write, mm-hmm. say what they want to say, meet with others, and have some right to self-determination, some form of democracy. And this is a monarchy. It's an authoritarian state. And people didn't really pay attention to the fact that social reforms, letting women drive, having movies, having rock stars, having WWE and Formula E races, it wasn't that's, you know, meaningless, as the many Saudis told me, if there's not real political reform.
And by the way, the other thing, when you said, you know, making Saudi Arabia welcoming to foreigners, one foreigner who he worked very well, you explained quite well in your piece, was the president of the United States. Was it his first overseas trip to Riyadh, or was just an early overseas trip to Riyadh?
It was not only his first trip. I don't know as a businessman if he'd been to Riyadh
president,
before.
Yeah.
This was his first trip abroad as president. Most presidents will go to Canada or Mexico or Europe. It was unprecedented for a president to decide to go to Saudi Arabia as his first trip. And the Saudis rolled out the red carpet. They put posters all over town. They projected big images of him.
Those were great pictures.
And they, you know, they took him to the sword dance, and they you know, had this. They gave him some big award, some bling around his neck. You know, they really feted him in a big, big way, much more than previous presidents.
So tell us about the beginnings of Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi.
Okay. You can pronounce it however you like.
I noticed that last night that there were all sorts of different pronunciations of that, and people went back and forth between Qatar and Qatar, so it left me not knowing what I should call anything. But Khashoggi, he was originally a supporter of MBS.
That's right. That's right. He was enthusiastic. He wasn't just a supporter. He was an ardent supporter of the war in Yemen. He was excited and enthusiastic about Mohammed bin Salman when he talked about economic change. And, you know, this is a very young country. 70% of the population is under the age of 30.
That's amazing, yeah.
And they have a lot of youth unemployment. It was a no-brainer that they had to get on the, you know, get onto it.
By the way,
start reforming. So he liked him. He supported the war in Yemen. He supported his reforms.
By the way, here's you with Khashoggi talking about the campaign in Yemen.
If Saudi Arabia waited for Mr. Obama to approve an intervention in Yemen, Yemen would have been gone and lost long time ago. It will be controlled by the Iranians and the Houthis. So we did not wait for Mr. Obama's approval. And I think that empowers Saudi Arabia.
Is Saudi Arabia committing human rights abuses in its bombing campaign?
Look, for Saudi Arabia, it is a 1939 moment.
So you're comparing Iran to Nazi Germany?
Yes. In Saudi Arabia, we are at that moment. We either accept Iranian hegemony or freedom.
So we have him comparing Saudi Arabia, in answer to your question, to Nazi Germany. And so what was the thing that turned him, Martin Smith? Was it writing that piece critical of Donald Trump and then being ordered by the leadership in Saudi Arabia to essentially keep his mouth shut at that point? Was that the tipping point, or what was it?
Well, that's an interesting moment in the film, I think. I don't think most people realize that he wasn't censored because he was criticizing the Crown Prince.
Yeah.
He was censored, told not to write, tweet, or appear on television because he criticized, well, he didn't even criticize Donald Trump. He just kind of made a sort of a cautionary note in a video conference into a Washington think tank, and he said, you know, we should be careful about Donald Trump. I think he said, you know, we had trouble with Obama, we might have more trouble with Trump. This was enough to have them censor him. That was the beginning. It was, he didn't really come out, I mean, he was silenced, but it was after he moved to the United States, after he felt like his intellectual life had been stopped. He couldn't express himself. And so when he got to the United States, he criticized what he saw going on in Saudi Arabia, which was that dozens of Saudi writers, journalists, academics, an economist, and others were being imprisoned for crimes that were alarmingly mild, such things, that stating that people were tweeting the wrong messages. They weren't supportive enough of the war in Qatar. They were one cleric was told that to be neutral in the war in Qatar was equivalent to treason. So he was very disturbed by this, and he started writing in the Washington Post.
Well, one of the things you point out is just a quick aside is that Saudi Arabians are practically are more fanatical about Twitter than Americans. You know, these great photographs of everybody with their face literally in their phone tweeting away, and how there was a crackdown on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had seen, Saudis in general had seen the power of social media to stir people, to allow people to express themselves. They called Twitter at one point the Saudi Congress, mm-hmm. Because it was, they don't have a Congress, they don't have that kind of deliberative body at all. It's all run by the royal court. But here was Twitter, and suddenly people could express themselves, and they decided that that needed to be managed. They were unleashing forces. They didn't know where it would go. They had seen what had happened during the Arab Spring in Egypt, for example, or Tunisia. They didn't want that in Saudi Arabia. So they used Twitter as a way, as a tool of surveillance and oppression.
So when did you first meet the Crown Prince? Was it 2017?
That's correct. Right? It was just after the inauguration of Donald Trump. I saw him. He was quite enthusiastic about that.
Describe that encounter and tell us about your texting relationship,
yeah.
Which is one of the most surreal things
I love it.
I've ever seen on Frontline, I must say, Martin Smith. But go ahead.
After I don't know how 35 years of Frontline, that's quite a statement to make. I've had a lot of surreal experiences around the world. I met him just after the inauguration of Trump, and he was very enthusiastic about that election because he was, they were very concerned about Obama. They didn't like Obama's policy, the nuclear deal in Iran, and chiding them and telling them that they needed to share the neighborhood. They didn't, like hearing that. And so they were very enthusiastic about Trump. And he reflected that, even ran across his office and picked up some bauble that he had received from the White House. And he was excited about that. And then the next day I get a text from him, a number, and says, this is my number, Mohammed bin Salman.
I love it.
And, I was surprised. And then, over time, we've had a number of exchanges. He likes to send me, more recently, he sent me concert footage from, I guess it was 50 Cent, some testimony of 50 Cent saying, don't ever mess with my peeps. The Saudis are my peeps, and don't mess with them. So he's very excited about Western culture. And he wants to sort of invite it into the kingdom, but he doesn't want to give people the kind of freedom to express themselves as any respectable rapper would appreciate.
Well, just to take another side trip from Khashoggi, sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, you capture that really
well. Call him Jamal, if you like.
Jamal. I'm just going to call him Jamal. One of the things you capture very well is how these scenes of people at the fun zones and the malls when they're riding all the rides. It's like an amusement park. And also, I didn't know they had no movie theaters. And now, they're up to 350
movie
theaters? They're not there yet. They've pledged to get there by 2030.
But that's a dramatic change, is not in the life of the people there, right?
I've seen tremendous change. So it's a mistake to say, this guy is like Kim in North Korea. He does want to have reform and open up the country and make it attractive to tourists and whatnot. And so he has movie theaters and fun zones and these big entertainment sporting events and whatnot. It's all very real. And over the time that I've been going there, in the last couple of years, I saw real change. I saw women dining in restaurants with men. Didn't see that in the past. There was always a separate family section. I saw women not worrying about covering their heads. The religious police are not visible. In Riyadh, at least, where I did most of my travels. So those changes are real. It just can't be confused with political rights.
And by the way, we should say that that at the same time that women are driving, I guess it's a little more than a year, the woman who essentially led the campaign, is she still in jail? I mean, you talked to her sister, and
yes,
it appears that she may have been tortured, burnt, beaten. It's un. I guess some of that stuff is not confirmed, but she's been in jail for quite a while, is she not?
Well, the human rights organizations that have gotten testimonies to her treatment in prison are very careful about making sure that that their sources are independent of one another. They're not echoes of one. And they have been very careful that they don't go with something if it comes from only from a family member, because that could be biased. So they're very careful as to how they assess whether or not accounts of torture, how much they want to stand on.
Well, the family members need to be careful, too, obviously, for potential even worse retaliation. That's what I took away from your interview with her sister. Is that not a fair takeaway?
They do. I mean, the Crown Prince is now engaging in collective punishment. Salah, who is the son, the only son of Jamal Khashoggi that is still in the country, has been put on a travel ban. And he's not a political figure or a writer or anything. So, yes, when Alia al-Hathloul speaks out on behalf of her sister, she's in Europe. So she says these things from the outside, and she's very careful about it. But they had tried to stay quiet about the situation with Lujain al-Hathloul, and it wasn't working. Then the Saudis came to the cell of Lujain and asked her to do a confession on videotape and state in that she had not been tortured. She refused that. So she remains in jail, as do other women who have been tortured and faced sexual abuse.
So back to Khashoggi, was it a accumulation of criticism of the Crown Prince and others in authority there, or was it the piece in the Washington Post about the so-called purge of the billionaires? Was there a When was his death warrant signed? What caused it, in your estimation, Martin Smith?
Well, it has to be an estimation. We don't know. It's an opaque system. The Crown Prince has been, he avoids really opening up about this. I think it's an accumulation. It's also that Jamal Khashoggi was a special case. He was an insider. He was a member of the family, if you will. He's not a royal. He's not an Al Saud. But he was close. He was a spokesman for the embassy in Washington, D.C. and in the U.K., as well as a journalist. He had been somebody they trusted, and he turned on them in their view and started speaking out. And I think over time, the NSA uncovered intercepts after the murder of Jamal that showed that the Crown Prince was speaking to his close aide Saad al-Qahtani and saying, you know, this guy is getting too influential. We got to do something about this. And he says to another aide, I think if we got to go get him and bring him back, and he resists, we got to show him a bullet.
Mm-hmm. Which was enough for virtually all the world other than President Trump and Secretary Pompeo. Here is your interview, which is something people have got to see, with the Minister of State and Foreign Affairs for Saudi Arabia discussing Khashoggi's death. Here's just a little piece of it.
These were security individuals. Security people have rotations. They sometimes serve for specific times in terms of security or other issues.
You're saying that this is being investigated by the public prosecutor?
Yes.
But at the same time, you have declared it a rogue operation. So you've reached a conclusion that this was a rogue operation before the investigation is complete.
Of course it's a rogue operation. Nobody authorized this. Who would authorize the murder of a citizen?
How do we know until there is an investigation?
It seems to me that you have made up your mind before you watched the...
No, you've made up your mind that it's a rogue operation.
It is a rogue operation because there is no authorization for them to commit this crime.
It was a chilling exchange with you and that minister.
Well, you know what was incredible? How soft-spoken and quiet he was. And you could see that he'd had a lot of practice at something or other, Martin, because he didn't rise up, you know?
That's his nature. I mean, he's been the foreign minister for a long time. He's now Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. They changed his office, but he does the same thing. But he's been the foreign minister, essentially, for many years, and that's his... That's his M.O. He's very quiet and almost precious in the way that he speaks.
Yeah.
So you get, correct me if I'm wrong, do you get a text from the Crown Prince or you text the Crown Prince saying you'd like to talk? He says yes, you hop on a plane to Saudi Arabia, and then what happens?
Well, he says to me repeatedly, I'll talk to you off the record. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is that you have an off-the-record conversation with him, and then after that you say, well, here's what you said, I'd like to go on the record with this, and he okays it. But the conversation, the important one that's in the documentary, was an off-the-record conversation and I went through no approval process because it was off the record. He never declared this is an off-the-record conversation. The Saudis tried to get me to agree that it was off the record, but it was not. You can't do it in hindsight. So that's the way they try to control the press, is by having these off-the-record conversations. Then you submit a quote, and then he goes on the record with that. But you know, that's not acceptable, and I won't. You know, I'm not going to play that game with him. Because that puts them in the driver's seat as to what they say. And he's a big boy. He's a world leader. He has to know how the rules of the game work.
So what did he say to you in that final conversation at a racetrack or wherever it was?
He said it was a horrible accident. And then I said, yeah, but the problem for you is that you're the guy in charge. And he says, that's right. It happened under my watch, so I take full responsibility. It happened under my watch. And then he added sort of oddly, I won't say that I did it or that I didn't do it. That's just words. I said, well, how can they do this without you knowing about it? And how can they take some, you know, your planes? And... You know, his answers are deeply unsatisfying. And I think what I would like to see going forward is more investigation. I know that's what the United Nations special rapporteur for extrajudicial killings would like to see. She's done the most complete report to date, but still there are questions, and the Saudis are not cooperating. what are they hiding? It's very likely, you know, I suspect that he ordered this killing and therefore it can't go any further in terms of an investigation.
You know, Martin Smith from Frontline, you have so many great scenes. Just a couple I wanted to mention to our listeners. The great scene of this orchestrated body double thing where they have Khashoggi coming out of the embassy. It's not him. It's a body double, but he's in all his clothes except for
all of Khashoggi's clothes.
His shoes. Apparently, Khashoggi's shoes didn't fit the body double, so he didn't have the shoes on. And then you go into a lot of detail about a roundup of the business people and princes that got nice quarters at the Ritz Hotel, which looked absolutely beautiful in the Frontline film. And yet it was more threatening, I think, than some of us thought. And you also point out that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, approved this roundup of all these business people and princes.
Yeah, he tweets... the harsh treatment, something about the harsh treatment that they're using on these people is more or less deserved. And as far as that body double, that was just one of a number of awkward, ham-fisted sort of efforts to cover up what had actually gone down. They were going to use this as a story that he had left the embassy and look at the surveillance footage. There he goes. It's a preposterous thing, and even President Trump said that this is the worst cover-up he's ever seen. And that's quite a statement.
Just one last thing. I want to return to what you said about the woman from the UN who's in your film who did the investigation. She seems to have concluded that what virtually all the world believes is the case, that it wouldn't have happened without the Crown Prince. When you say there, it needs further investigation, I mean, who is to do this? Is it the UN? It's surely not the United States of America. Who is to continue to scrutinize this, Martin?
Well, I think the UN could step up here. I think all countries could. The Trump administration is unwilling, for its various reasons, to put more pressure on the Crown Prince. And they're just hoping that they can shut the door and the storm will pass. We're at this anniversary period now of the murder because it happened a year ago tomorrow. And they just are going to sort of board up the windows and ride out the storm. I think they're very surprised that it's still a matter of concern around the world. I think they thought this would pass. That was the sense I had from talking to Saudis. And that just hasn't been the case. And I'm, you know, and I give a lot of credit to the Washington Post and the New York Times for not letting the death and murder and dismemberment of a journalist go unnoticed. So I think pressure can be kept up by the media. I think it can also be done by the United Nations. You know, the investigation that was done by volunteers who did that work, that, you know, more than 100-page investigation of what happened for no pay.
Yeah. Well, clearly Frontline and you are keeping the pressure on, too. Congratulations yet again, Martin. We learned a lot. It was really terrific and powerful. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much, Martin, for being with us again.
Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you. Martin Smith is a producer and correspondent for Frontline. His latest Frontline documentary is The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. It airs tonight at 9 on PBS and is now streaming on pbs.org/frontline. Coming up, CNN's John King is here to go over the latest political headlines. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us online to go over the latest political headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. John, as you know, is the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8. Hello there, John King.
Happy Tuesday.
And to you.
Well, it's a happy and very busy Tuesday. I just want to make sure, John King, since we've been on the air, that we haven't missed, I don't think so, some big break in story. But can you bring us up to date on the developments today, the big ones?
The biggest development, in my view, today is Secretary Pompeo sending a letter to the House Democrats essentially saying, go away. This is the first formal action since it's become an impeachment inquiry, an official impeachment inquiry by the Democrats. And the Democrats wanted to, starting tomorrow, start taking depositions of State Department people who most Americans don't know their names, but the former ambassador to Ukraine. She's now back. She was withdrawn by the Trump administration, and she's back in the Foreign Service at the State Department. The day after that, they wanted to interview Kurt Volker, who was the president's special envoy to Ukraine. He just resigned on Friday, I'm told, after some tough conversations with the White House about whether or not he should cooperate. And the Secretary Pompeo, and there's some other State Department officials, too, they want to interview. And, of course, then they also want documents from the secretary himself. Pompeo sent a very tough-worded letter essentially saying Congress is trying to bully these people and he will not let them be deposed. This sets up a remarkable confrontation. It's a really big deal in the sense that the Democrats have said they're not going to court for weeks and months to try to get any testimony here, that they will just roll that into an obstruction article of impeachment against the White House. But if you want to know what exactly was Rudy Giuliani doing in Ukraine? Who helped set up the meetings? Did career State Department officials raise concerns that he was freelancing and running a shadow foreign policy or getting using the levers and the resources of the United States government to get political dirt? On the Biden family, you need the testimony of these witnesses because they were involved in all of this. So we now have a giant confrontation between the Pompeo did the letter, but this is the White House and the president, of course, between the administration and the Congress over what are the fundamental building blocks of the impeachment case.
Well, were they subpoenaed? They were not subpoenaed, I don't think, the State Department people. Were they or were they?
Because they were not.
They were not.
Request,
so
it
that's
was a request for a scheduled deposition. So I assume the next move is subpoena. But if you read the Pompeo letter, Marjorie, there's just no way you're going to read that letter and say, oh, well, when they actually send a subpoena, then
well,
he's
I guess,
going to go testify.
I guess, you know, we talk all the time about how the Republicans play hardball and the Democrats are looking up the rule book. I mean, they could hold, if they wanted to, I believe, Pompeo in contempt, couldn't they?
They could. They absolutely could, and they just might. The issue being that the president's team seems not to be worried about that part of it. And in an odd way, Marjorie, the president is trying to hold Republicans right now. You see public opinion polling starting to move, and don't overstate this, but it's starting to move in the way of more and more Americans favor impeachment or at least a tough impeachment inquiry to answer these questions. So if you read the Pompeo letter, if you read the president's tweets, the part of the White House strategy is keep the Republicans. Make this a partisan fight. The Democrats are trying to bully us. The Democrats are overreaching to try to get Republicans to go into their tribal corner. Because the more Republicans who raise their hand and say, you know, not sure this is impeachable, but I've got some serious questions here. Or I don't think this is impeachable, but stop bullying this whistleblower and treat this person with respect because whistleblowers are patriots, not problems. If more Republicans do that, the president has a problem. And so if you look... holding Pompeo in contempt would be a party-line vote that the president would say is a partisan witch hunt. I'm not saying that's what it is. That's for the people listening to decide. But in an odd way, the president wants to make this all political, all confrontational. So in an odd way, it could play into his strategy.
Okay, just one last thing, because the hypocrisy of Secretary Pompeo has to be noted here. He is bullying people already by the dozens in his own State Department, going after them for emails involving Hillary Clinton and her private server that were unclassified, that are now, as I understand it, John, being reclassified.
Retroactively.
So that's extremely threatening in a even a criminal way toward his own employees. I guess that's the problem for me, is that it's kind of like these people keep getting to slide with these ridiculous arguments, and then we just say, okay, all right, fine. You know what I mean?
It has been part of their success, Marjorie. They stir up so much, and everyone's so busy, and they make it confusing that they get away with it, without a doubt, including, I'm not defending, you know, Hunter Biden didn't get a contract to be on the board of Ukrainian Energy Company. Put it this way, if his name was, you know, Hunter Egan,
correct,
or Hunter Browdy,
yep,
he may not have gotten that business. So I'm not defending Hunter Biden's work. But the things that people say about Hunter Biden and what he did, and specifically the things they say about Joe Biden getting the prosecutor fired, they're just factually not true.
They're right? Lies.
They're just not true. They're lies. Thank you. They're lies. And they're being made by people. Rudy Giuliani has all kinds of international clients, just like Hunter Biden, that he's making a boatload of money off. And he's sitting in a TV studio every night saying Hunter Biden's a crook. Give me a break.
Well, can we move up the chain then to the boss? The President of the United States just a few minutes ago said yet again, now he wants to, quote, interview the whistleblower. Let's be charitable and say he doesn't understand the law. Or we could be uncharitable and say he is abusing the law. This is another circumstance where it seems to me the Democrats are put to the test. Are they going to allow the President of the United States, who is being implicated, which I think is a euphemism, by a whistleblower, to basically threaten the whistleblower and totally undercut the whole point of the Whistleblower Act? I mean, I guess, John, what it is, and I'll voice Marjorie's frustration too, the Democrats' performance in the Judiciary Committee with Corey Lewandowski, the only thing that made it salvageable is that Lewandowski was more pathetic than they were. Do you get the sense, as a longtime observer of this, that they have a game plan how to deal with this whole pile of, I would argue, corruption, or at least alleged corruption and violation of law? Do they have a plan?
I think part of the White House strategy, Jim, is that they think the Democrats are not up to the challenge. And so one of the reasons they keep throwing, they're rolling things into the road, if you will, to get the Democrats to, drive into the potholes and get flat tires and to make it about them. What you said is the very reason that this is now being led by Adam Schiff and the Intelligence Committee, not Jerry Nadler and the Judiciary Committee. Now, Chairman Schiff made a big mistake when he did the parody off the top of his
meeting. I agree.
Because this is not, impeachment's not funny. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, an independent. Impeaching any president of the United States is not funny. It should be treated with respect and gravity and seriousness. And Chairman Schiff was trying to make a joke about something that is not funny. And the rest of the hearing, he performed actually pretty well. And if you look at the very end of it, again, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, as an attorney, as an inquisitor, he asked very good questions, sharp questions, listened to the witness and asked good follow-up questions at the end. What he did at the beginning has hurt the Democrats because it allows the Republicans to say, This man is making a parody of something that's very important. So I think you raise a great question. Do the Democrats have it together as we proceed? I think how they respond to this defiance from Secretary Pompeo is going to be very interesting about it, because we know that what the president says, most of it is not true. What Rudy Giuliani says, most of it is not true. I call it the Trumpaganda machine of Fox News and the conservative Twitterverse is now coming to spread these conspiracy theories and falsehoods as well. Can the Democrats fight through that? One point about the whistleblower, I don't think, Jim, it's just about intimidating the current whistleblower, which it is. It's direct intimidation of somebody who, we'll see if the facts, so far all the facts in that complaint have been held up. We'll see if they all are by the end of all this. But you want people, even if they're wrong sometimes, you want people in government to raise their hand if they think they see corruption and abuse. If the facts turn out that their complaint was wrong, as long as it was made in good faith, that person should not be punished. That person should be applauded, and you just present to them, here's what happened.
And his or her anonymity protected, by the way, along the way.
But what about somebody else, Jim? This whistleblower.
That's a great point.
Let's assume there are one or two other people in government who are saying, okay, I've been biting my tongue for
a long
time.
Well, there are. There's the IRS.
Now that I raised my hand.
There's the IRS whistleblower who has done some whistleblowing. We don't know who that is or what the extent of the whistleblowing details are, but apparently it involves the president's taxes, and there's a whistleblower that's complained about that. We haven't gotten the details.
Manipulation of the audit is the allegation.
Yes, so you wonder, that's a very good point, John. Maybe the president is worried about the IRS whistleblower.
Or the next one.
Or anybody else in the national security, in the Ukraine / conduct of the White House / abuse of power question we're talking about. I want to just say this because it came up. Chuck Grassley, senior Republican senator from Iowa, issued a statement today. He has a long history of supporting whistleblowers going back a couple decades. As long as I've been in Washington, Chuck Grassley has cared about these issues. He issued a very strongly worded statement today saying everybody should back off. He says at the end of that statement, I think impeachment is too far. It's a bridge too far. But in terms of respecting the whistleblower and getting to the bottom of the facts, I think it is important that a senior Republican at a time his party is impugning and questioning the integrity and the character of this person said back off.
So we're talking to John King from CNN. I don't know if you're aware, but for the last 8 days, I was looking up this morning to see if there still was a race for the Democratic nomination for president or if they had decided to all retire. Virtually no coverage. We have in local paper, we have Elizabeth Warren taking selfies is the story. I'm assuming that the people who suffer most from this all impeachment all the time coverage, which I assume is going to go on for a while, the people who suffer the most on the Democratic side are those who are looking to climb out of second and third tier position, because the assumption, I guess I make, is that the people in the top spots just get locked in until the impeachment furor dies down a little, if it ever does. Is that a fair analysis or no?
I think it's a fair initial analysis, and then we watch and see what happens. Does this help or hurt Joe Biden? That he's, his character is being challenged like this, in the sense that, is there a sympathetic Trump's attacking Biden movement that holds him up, or is there, even if we don't believe any of the things being said, we don't want Biden to get Clinton, if you will, that veteran Washington, swampy, been around forever, not going to change. Can Trump somehow make Biden the incumbent as he did with Hillary Clinton? And run against her and run against Washington. Everyone says, wait, Trump's the incumbent, but he pulled the Houdini trick before. We've watched it play out. So I have a question about that. I also would say this, that you're right. The national oxygen now is all in impeachment. That hurts. If you're a lower-tier candidate, you're not going to be on cable news nationally as much. Can somebody find the opportunity here to use that on the ground in Iowa or New Hampshire or Nevada or South Carolina, one of the early states, to sneak up on us? While everyone's talking about impeachment as a national conversation, can one of the struggling candidates, or some, whether in the bottom or the middle of the pack, find a way to just keep working, shoe leather, and maybe we don't see it? It's what Rick Santorum did back in 2012, for example. He was at 2% of the polls, then he was at 3% of the polls, and then he tied Mitt Romney, actually beat him by a few votes on, you know, Republican. Republicans have a primary, not a caucus, in Iowa. It can be done. Will somebody do it? I don't know, but that's I would just your reflex is exactly right. I would just add the caveat that maybe somebody will find a way to use the opportunity, if you will. No one's paying attention to me. I'm going to surprise people.
Talking to John King from CNN.
You know, John King, I wonder if anybody knows, and maybe there haven't been enough impeachments of United States presidents to know this, but I know that the North Korea and the United States are going to resume nuclear talks on Saturday. But I wonder, with the whole world now knowing that nearly half of Americans want to get rid of the president, how much this impacts his power worldwide and his ability to get things done, or even nationally. I mean, you know, are the North Koreans going to be thinking about his political problems when they're talking to him about nuclear weapons?
I think in North Korea it's a different context, in the sense that if you're any country, if you're North Korea and you're thinking about giving up your nuclear weapons, Donald Trump's going to be president either for a year and a half or for 5.5 years. And then there's going to be somebody else. And if you actually did give up your nuclear weapons, what does that world look like? So I think in the terms of the North Korean nuclear program, that is such a big paradigm fundamental shift that they have to be thinking beyond the next year and a half. If you're China trying to get a trade deal, and you know that President Trump is probably very eager now to show that he's getting stuff done, you might think you have a little bit more leverage at this moment. I could see something like that coming up. If you're somebody else involved in a negotiation that is specifically about the here and now with the Trump administration, you might think you have a little bit more leverage because the president wants to prove he can get things done. I lived through this. I covered the Clinton White House in the impeachment days then, and I just remember when the international meetings like the G7 or the NATO summit coincided in the middle of all this. It was just remarkable how much ambassadors and the chief of staff, to chancellors and prime ministers would pull us aside, pull reporters aside to whisper, and is he going to be impeached? Is he going to lose office? Well, the gossip factory, if you will, just becomes incredible.
You know, John King, Marjorie mentioned, or you mentioned earlier in this conversation, recent polling. I know CNN did something. Could you give us what you consider to be the takeaways from, admittedly, it's only a week into this process, what trends we should be looking at that are significant?
I would watch the overall impeachment number, and then if it continues to rise, and it did rise in recent days. Now, everybody has, if you follow the news, all you've been hearing for the last week is Ukraine, impeachment inquiry, impeachment inquiry, impeachment inquiry. So I'm not surprised that the numbers moved some. The question is that the beginning of a move toward impeaching the president, and it keeps going up, or does it plateau at some point when people say, okay, I've processed this now? And this, as this goes on for weeks and potentially months, does it grow or whatever? So I would watch the baseline right now, and if you're the White House, you're concerned. Why? Because about just shy of half in our poll, 47% of Americans think he should be impeached and removed from office, not just for the inquiry. They think he should be impeached and removed from office. Among independents and among Republicans, that number has gone up. Not a ton among Republicans, and it's almost all young Republicans, which is interesting, but I would just watch that. Again, is that because they've been inundated with the news? Mm-hmm. And that's how they feel at the moment, but they'll process more information and maybe come back to the base, or does it keep going? So I would look at the polls this week and not, run off to Vegas, but to use them as your baseline and then compare them a week from now, 2 weeks from now, and a month from now. If the trend that we see this week continues, well, the president's in trouble because impeachment is not a criminal trial, it's a political trial, and Republicans will stay with him as long as public support is at least split, and as long as when you look at the subset of Republicans are against this. If the Republican number starts to move, that's when you'll start circling back to the other Republican members of Congress and seeing if their opinion is changing.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning that that if Pompeo continues to stonewall and says no one's going to testify even after subpoena, the Democrats could roll that into an overall obstruction of justice charge. I suppose that could be true of anywhere in this investigation if the White House obstructs. I mean, obstruction of justice is a big problem.
Yeah, Bill Clinton was impeached for obstruction. Richard Nixon was impeached for obstruction. There is a history of, you know, if you don't cooperate, we will count that as obstruction of Congress. And again, that's a political decision. It's not, you know, somebody in law school might have a different definition of, you know, obstruction. This is a political decision which will be made by the House of Representatives. My point is, and the Democrats say they're prepared to do that. I do think, though, especially if you want to make this a Democratic enterprise where the Democrats impeach the President of the United States and then the Republican Senate says no, then you could do that tomorrow or close to tomorrow. They don't need that many more Democratic votes to get there. If you believe you have a strong case against the president and you want to take your case to the American people, I think it is critical, A, that the Democrats, to Jim's point, handle themselves professionally, and B, that they try to open the minds of Republicans and independents who are right now either against impeachment or on the fence about impeachment by showing them the facts, which is why these witnesses Pompeo is denying Congress are so critical. They know what happened in Ukraine. They know who Giuliani was meeting with. They know how many times. They know it was for months before the July 25th call to the president of Ukraine and weeks after that call. They can fill in the blanks as to whether this was some hand-handed effort by the president that maybe is ridiculous but not impeachable, or whether it was an abuse of power and the use of government resources for personal political gain by the President of the United States, which is what the Democrats think, and which if you just read the transcript of the call and the whistleblower complaint, there's a threshold case for that. But if the Democrats want to change minds for people who are, you know, predisposed to think no or just have their partisan reflex here, then they need those witnesses. And so getting them, that's the challenge for the Democrats. You'd really, yes, you can just roll it into an obstruction complaint, but you'd really like to be able to document your case.
John King,
thanks as always.
Take care, guys. I'll see you next Tuesday. And, Jim, I hope to see you Thursday.
Oh, right. Men Who Cook for Women's Health Thursday night. I didn't forget, but I forgot for a second. John will be there. I will be there. A lot of people will be there, including, hopefully, you for a very good cause. See you Thursday night, John.
Thank you, John.
Take care, guys.
John joins us every week. He's CNN's chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock and weekdays at noon.
By the way, let me just say, if you want to go to this event on Thursday night, which is great, Marjorie's been there in the past, mayor, police commissioner, others essentially serve as chefs and other things. menofboston.com. All the proceeds go to Codman Square Health Center's women's health program.
Coming up, Ryan Landry is here to talk about what it was like to win the rescue dog jackpot.
This is unbelievable story.
You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for You Get the Picture, Ryan Landry's recurring segment of social observations. Ryan, of course, is a playwright, lyricist, actor, and founder of the Gold Dust Orphans Theatrical Company. Their production of The Ebonic Woman opens in New York City on October 10th. Is it open on the 10th or 18th? Sorry, which
what?
Is...
On the 18th
18th,
October,
my apologies.
Yeah.
Opens in New York City on October 18th. And their next production, what's it called again, Marjorie? I can't remember. What's their next production called?
Christmas on Uranus.
Thank you. Marjorie said it, not me.
Opens at their
brand new location, the Lithuanian Hall in South Boston. That is December 5th. And believe me, we will be there. Ryan Landry, it's great to see you.
Bonjour.
And bonjour to you, too. Or, I think more appropriately, hello, Dolly.
Yes, hello.
Okay, Dolly. Why are we saying that, Marjorie?
Well, we're saying it because you and your adorable partner, Scott Martino, won this rescue dog sweepstakes and now have a beautiful new puppy who looks like Salvador Dali. Well, that's why he's called Dolly, or she's called Dolly. How did you win this contest, Ryan?
I don't know. There were
100 at least,
yeah,
right?
Applications from all over the world, from Italy and Canada. And for some reason, they chose us.
Well, I thought it was very interesting. They came to conduct the interview down in Provincetown on the very day of the Carnival Parade,
yeah,
which could have been an awkward situation.
Well, it was a video interview, see? So we had to explain why everyone was wearing thongs.
Exactly.
You know.
by the dozens.
How did you explain that? I'm curious.
Just said it's Carnival Day. Get ready because there are going to be some scantily clad ladies of both sexes walking up and down
walking
the street.
Up and down the street.
Can I just say, for those who think this is a made-up story, this is not only real, it's a big story in the Cape Cod Times.
Huge.
Salvador Dali, look-alike rescue pup, finds home in Provincetown. And the reason I'm referencing the article is, even though it's a radio show, you've got to go see the article because there's a slideshow. And if you think we're exaggerating that this dog looks exactly like Salvador Dali, you've got another thing coming. It looks like Salvador Dali.
Yeah, I think your listeners depend on the truth from both of you, and you never let you steer them wrong. So
never.
I don't know why anyone would doubt the story, but go ahead and go on the Cape Cod Times.
Yeah,
and
a little mustache looks
pictures.
Like Salvador Dali. So and this dog was on television. People knew about this,
oh,
right?
Oh yeah, all over the world. He was in the Daily Mail in London.
Exactly. And so you were in the sweepstakes with 100 other applicants.
Yeah.
And now previously, I guess you just told me you lost your 17 and a half year old
Rhoda. Was in many of my plays and musicals.
We
and
saw now, Rhoda perform actually
yeah,
in your
yeah.
plays.
Now Dolly's going to be the new performer.
And
but I think always as Inspector Perrault. What's his Perrault?
Perrault, yes.
Inspector
yeah.
Perrault from the Agatha Christie.
Because all she needs is a little like bowler hat.
Yeah, perfect.
And the mustache will do the rest.
Perfect. And you have a 12-year-old Jack Russell. Mm-hmm. And when poor Rhoda died, a long, nice long life at 17 and a half, Scott did not want to get another dog. But you convinced him.
No, he didn't. Well, no, what happened was he saw her on the internet and screamed out loud, and I thought he'd burned himself in the kitchen. So I ran in.
That's what I would have thought.
To see what was going on. And I saw the picture, and he was in love immediately. And once he's in love, you can't turn his mind around. So I said, okay, and we tried.
You wrote a letter.
And then we were told that that someone else had adopted her.
Aww.
And so Scott was all heartbroken. And then I got an email from the rescue saying, hey, did you guys change your mind? Did you get my last email? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I thought the dog was already adopted. And she said, oh, no, the lady changed her mind. She had some other situation come up. So you guys are the ones to get her. And I said, does Scott know this? Because if he did, he would be screaming right now. And she said, I don't know. I sent the email to him. So I thought that I could get away with murder with a big surprise thing. So I got cake and big dinners and, you know, like the whole thing, steaks on the Bobby, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And had all the friends come over at the appropriate time. And I came home with Dali and I handed her to Scott and he was crying. And I said, you know, he goes, yeah, I know. I knew. And I'm like, how did you know? He's like, well, when you paid for the adoption, they sent me a receipt.
Okay. Now, did you know Dolly, by the way, Jim, is part pit bull?
I did not. Oh, that actually, I didn't know that.
Jim is,
I
have Jim, a pit
nothing
bull.
Wrong with pit bull.
Jim is not nice about pit bulls.
Pit bulls who eat people.
By the way, can
nice.
I tell you, we used to do shows regularly on pit bulls.
Yeah.
And people
He's only
would,
part pit bull.
People
part
would call
shepherd,
all the
pit
time
bull.
And say, I've had a pit bull forever. It's the sweetest dog ever, the sweetest. My baby and the pit bulls sleep in the same bed. And my response to them, and I mean this sincerely, is the pit bull is the sweetest dog in the world until it puts your baby's head in its mouth.
You're just paranoid because of Siegfried and Roy or something. Something happened in your
That was a tiger. That was not a pit bull. So would you have picked you? Can you be objective enough to know?
Damn right, I would have.
You would have picked you.
Yeah, that dog's going to have a purpose
so
on stage.
Was
12-year-old
Violet a little upset that this little puppy?
She
came
was
into
a little
Alistair
Growly at first,
yeah.
And then she got over herself, and then now they're snuggling together.
Are
so
they snuggling together?
Yeah, they're sleeping together.
Oh, good!
It's all
I
fine.
Love it.
We're talking
okay.
to Ryan Landry. Yeah.
So
it's a lesbian relationship at this point.
That's a beautiful thing.
So
yeah.
Tell us about Gay Guys and the late great Judy Garland. Is now a remake of a film starring Renee.
Oh,
Zellweger.
Won't they let her die already?
What
I met Renee Zellweger.
You did?
I don't think she's a good actress at all. And she's got two expressions. One that looks like she has to go to the bathroom.
It
and
does.
Two, like she smells like that. She's smelling
somebody
someone
else has
going,
gone to the bathroom.
Has gone to
no,
the bathroom.
She does have that little kind of that pursing of the lips kind of
I
thing.
I don't know what the... Well, I don't purse my lips when I smell someone going to the bathroom.
So, we don't need to know about that, but thank you. But in all seriousness, what is the gay Judy Garland connection thing? It's huge.
I think it all happened with the Stonewall riots. You know, those happened on the night of Judy Garland's death, and I think it's a
Wait,
symbol
is that,
thing.
Is that true? It was.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
It was the night. It was night Judy Garland died, or was her birthday? I forget. It's
this should have been
one.
In the story.
It was a major Judy Garland
day,
thing.
50 years
when
ago,
when Stonewall
obviously.
Happened, you know? And the Queens had had enough, and they started throwing bricks and such.
Boy, they should have said that in the Guardian story.
Well, assuming it's true.
Well, the Guardian, they like to keep their stories short and sweet.
Yeah, they know? Do keep them short and sweet. Yeah. So I assume you did not see the Judy Garland, Renee Zellweger
movie? No, I don't have much interest. But I say Judy Garland was fantastic, and I think you just get yourself a nice glass of rosé or Chablis and put the record on and sit home and listen to it, and then you're going to really experience the beauty that was Judy Garland. I don't think another movie about her drug habits or her tough life. Have you ever heard Judy Speaks? It's a recording of Judy Garland when she's really stoned talking about how she about her life, and she recorded herself because she was going to write a book, and the whole thing got lost, and then someone found it, and I have a copy of it if you
really?
Want it. Yeah,
I'd
she
actually
was really
love to hear
stoned
it. She,
on
by the
drugs
way,
or
she
drunk?
Died. I just looked. She died 6 days before Stonewall. You were so that's huge.
Was she drunk or was she on drugs?
She you can see her tell she's pretty high, and you can hear her saying things. If I died tomorrow, the headline of the newspaper would read, Judy Garland dies with 200 other nobodies, or something.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was really not very pleasant. So.
Yeah, you know, she did have a very.
So she had a hard time.
Yeah, she had a hard
but
time.
But I love Liza.
Liza's still around and kicking.
Oh, I'm nutty.
Wait,
Liza.
She is still
she
around?
She's a chain smoker.
She looks just like her mother, too.
Yeah, she goes.
Well, she sounds. There are moments when she sounds like her mother.
Well, not
too.
Anymore.
When was the last time you saw Liza Minnelli?
At her birthday party.
No, you did.
Yes,
that
I
is
did.
Not true.
It
is too true.
You were at Liza Minnelli's birthday party?
Yes, I was. My friend Daniel Nardiccio produced her show at Town Hall in New York, and I went, and that was the night of her birthday, and I went.
You can't keep singing when you're smoking two packs a day. It just doesn't work.
But while we're name dropping, can I tell you who I met, one of my biggest heroes of all time?
Who's that?
A great, great theater critic and one of the greatest writers of
our
day.
Oh, the Butcher of Broadway.
Frank Rich. Well, I didn't look at him as a butcher.
That's what
he was
his
more
nickname
like Mrs.
was.
Lovett than he was a butcher.
So where'd you meet him?
I met him at a party for a movie that I was in called Bully, Coward, Victim, The Story of Roy Cohn, because I had met Roy Cohn one time.
You were in
Whoa.
A movie?
Yeah.
I don't care about that.
I have
movie.
5 minutes.
Wait a
minute. Second. When did you meet
five
Roy Cohn? We talk
in the
a
late
lot about
70s.
Roy. Is that so? What was it? What were the circumstances?
I was sleeping with his boyfriend.
Is that really true?
Yeah. Well, they took me. These Queens took me in a car very late at night after a lot of cocaine. Took me in this car, and it was almost like they like it was a covert operation. It was a long, well, you'll see it in the movie. And they took me the long, long way, and I guess it was Westchester. I don't know geography. I flunked geography. But we went to this country house, and there he was sitting on the couch in this black sort of velour robe looking very reptilian, you know, and we discussed music. We discussed, he had an album that I loved called Mabel Mercer and Bobby Short, live at Town Hall.
I saw Bobby Short, by the way.
So, I love him.
So was he out then, or was he still in the closet?
I don't think he was ever out.
I don't think he was either, actually.
But he wasn't in the closet either. Yeah. I mean, when he was in Provincetown, it was like, line him up. You
and
know?
By the way, for those who don't are not faithful fans of the show, first of all, shame on you. But secondly, the reason we discuss Roy Cohn as often as we do is because of the influence Roy Cohn has his lawyer and mentor.
Yeah.
Forget the McCarthy hearings to
Donald Trump.
Listen to this.
What?
Wait till you see this bit in the movie where Roy Cohn is talking about Trump. It's somewhere in like the early 80s, talking about him. And I remember one of the quotes was, well, you know, with him, next stop, Moscow. It's right there. No lie. It's in the movie. They dug it up among all the research. I said to Ivy, the director, I was like, just take that snippet. Give it to me and everyone else, and let's put it out there because everyone will be curious about your movie because this footage is unbelievable. He talks at length about Donald Trump's connections to Russia and his love of Russia.
And was it about money or what?
I don't know. Yeah, it's about power always.
Yeah.
You know, it's always about power.
So before you leave this, I'm sorry. So can we discuss Frank Rich, obviously one of the great theater critics ever.
Always, yeah.
Frank Rich, one of the great political columnists ever. That's when he was on our show a few years ago. But what has he done in the last couple of years, which was a huge contribution?
Producing Veep.
Veep, exactly.
And he
Most
also
people
was
don't
the producer
that.
Of this film. One of the producers
oh, he
of
was.
This film, yeah.
And when is this thing coming out?
It's on HBO, so I don't know. Whenever HBO decides to let it out, I guess. But there's also another Roy Cohn film at the same time. It was playing at film form. I just drove him from New York because I was at the screening at Lincoln Center, by the way. And there's another one called Where's My Roy Cohn? So all of a sudden, Roy Cohn is becoming bubbling back up to the surface like a filthy, like that water you have when you eat, when you make spaghetti sauce and you clean the dishes. And you know that really filmy water?
I
That's
do.
Kind of Roy Cohn.
So you knew his boyfriend.
Yeah, Harry.
So
he had many
boyfriends.
Quote, knew
his boyfriend.
Did Harry
just
give
described.
You any insights into the character?
He gave
of
me
Roy
more
Cohn?
Than insights, but we can't talk about that.
Because he does.
That's why I'm on medication.
He does look reptilian. Oh, I mean, you think of you.
Oh, Harry didn't.
No. I mean, was it was he very attractive, Harry?
Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to Roy Cohn.
No, but do you know the impact that Roy Cohn had on this country?
Huge.
Beyond being counsel in McCarthy.
Well, he also executed the Rosenbergs, and Ivy is Ethel and Julius Rosenberg's granddaughter.
Actually, I just realized I had read about that. But you know the impact he had on Donald Trump. When you see, if people haven't seen one of the great documentaries that Frontline does every 4 years, it does something called The Choice, which is 2 hours on each of the candidates of the two major parties. The one that was on Donald Trump so perfectly captured the Cohn-Trump connection and the influence, Roy Cohn, on how Trump treats the world and how he treats fact and reality.
And also how
all
he treated
Roy Cohn.
Roy Cohn when Cohn got sick with AIDS.
Oh, he just turned his back
he
on
just
him. Well,
his
they
back.
All did. Well, they should have anyway. I mean, not excusing.
No, they shouldn't have anyway.
You know, not excusing
they should have changed
the circus peanut in office. But
the president was pretty much, I thought, neutral, if not pro-gay, before he became the president. He was
a
Democratic
I don't think
liberal.
He's pro-anything but himself. He doesn't care.
He'd
be pro-gay if he thought it would get him
help
votes
him.
Or
I
money
agree.
Or rent his condos or something.
So you think he just ditched Cohn because of the AIDS?
Because it wasn't the AIDS. It was just he was done with him. He lost the power, and so, you know, this pig sniffing for truffles goes into another field. That's all.
You know what we're doing in tribute to you, and I hope you appreciate this. I have a feeling you won't appreciate it as much as you should.
I probably won't.
Because you're moving, is it called the Lithuanian Hole in South Boston?
Yes. Listen to this.
Yes.
Okay. Christmas on Uranus. It's going to be so fantastic.
I get
to play the Dr. Smith role, except for I'm playing it as Dorothy Spornak from the Golden Girls.
So I
love Dorothy.
Dr. Spornak. And the robot is my mother, Sophia.
Wait a second. The robot is your mother?
No, it's... But I'm just mixing up the Golden Girls
I got
with
it.
Lost
okay. Oh,
in
I got
Space.
It. Fine.
Have
okay.
you ever seen Lost in Space?
Yeah, once I saw
the
Lost in Space.
The 60s version? It's so fantastic.
So,
what an acid trip.
But can I explain to you what we decided to do? Chelsea and Marjorie and I got together, and we decided as a tribute to your new venue and to you that every week you're with us, we will do a modest tribute to something Lithuanian. Do
you know?
Thank you very much. So this week we decided to single out the fact that one of my favorites ever, Leonard Cohen. Are you aware of the fact that there is a statue, the only statue in the world, to Leonard Cohen, who never visited Lithuania, to Leonard Cohen in Lithuania?
I am aware of this. And I want to talk a little bit about statues.
Please,
okay?
You have 30 seconds.
Okay, first of all, I am all for taking down Confederate statues. However, the only thing I want is to have the same sculptors do the new ones. I don't give us a Harriet Tubman, give us a Frederick Douglass, but please make them look like people. There are so many bad sculptors out there. This Leonard Cohen sculpture
looks exactly
pretty darn good.
It looks like Leonard Cohen.
Yeah,
it does.
I think so. I don't think it's very good.
It's our tribute to Lithuania.
Well, it's modern.
It's modern. Okay. Yeah. Ryan Landry,
nice
thank
to
you
see
very
what's
Ryan
my
Landry.
Christmas show called again, Marjorie?
Christmas on Uranus.
Exactly. Marjorie said
it. I said it, really, said it several times
I think
times
it's the
now.
Only reason he named it that, actually. But go ahead.
Damn right.
And I tell you what, I'm very happy for you and your new little puppy. That's wonderful.
Thanks.
Ryan
Hello,
Landry
Dolly.
Is a playwright, lyricist, actor, founder of the Gold Dust Orphans.
Orphans,
theatrical company. The production of The Ebonic Woman opens in New York on October
18th.
And opens in New York. On October 18th. And Christmas on Uranus opens at the brand new location, the Lithuanian Hall in South Boston, on December 5th. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow, executive editor from WGBH, Jared Bowen, will be with us, our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, and our national security expert, Juliet Kayyem. What's on television, Jim Brown?
We're obviously going to follow the impeachment thing, and two state reps who just got back from Honduras trying to figure out what's going on with this whole immigration crisis. They'll be joining me as well. I just want to do a shout-out. Hub Week starts today for the next 3 days, the 2019 Fall Festival. It's the fifth one. We'll be in the Seaport. And you know, this is sponsored by The Globe, Harvard, MIT, and MGH. And it's evolved in this year-long celebration of the innovative thought leaders from art, science, and technology. It's great.
Check them out at hubweek.org. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thank you so much for tuning in.
See you
Have
tomorrow.
A great afternoon, and I hope you tune in again tomorrow. Bye.